Thanks for calling. Wait all night for calls like this.
...720 WGN. You are listening to the Nick DiGilio Show every weeknight, 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. This is the producer of the Nick DiGilio Show, Tom Hush. Nick DiGilio is sick tonight, and we wish him well. He's feeling a little under the weather, so we're going to take the opportunity to play back some of our favorite interviews over the last couple weeks, just in case you miss them, and just in case you want to give them another listen, we've got them here for you. The first we'll play here is coming to us from the Factory Theater, Nick's old stomping grounds, where he was the artistic director. He invited the Factory Theater to join him back on the show a couple weeks ago to talk about their latest production, Last Night in Karaoke Town, which is currently playing over there at the Factory Theater. So you've got a cast of characters, the director and the two writers from the Factory Theater, chatting with their old pal, Nick DiGilio. Again, Nick is out sick tonight, so we will be playing back some of the favorite interviews of the last couple weeks and get you all caught up, so when he comes back, you are ready for some fresh stuff. So, you're listening to 720 WGN, the Nick DiGilio Show. Here are the members of the Factory Theater talking about Last Night in Karaoke Town.
I want to say hello to, right in studio, an old friend of mine who I've known for many years and a person who I just met. There is a new play at the Factory Theater, and the Factory Theater is a theater company that I was with for many, many years and was lucky enough to have acted in, written, and directed a bunch of shows there, and they continue to go. It's over 25 years now, right?
That's right.
The play is called Last Night in Karaoke Town. It opens on Valentine's Day, or previews on Valentine's Day, correct?
That's right.
And the writer and director, and the co-writer as well, he's on the phone with us. Kirk is in L.A. We have a couple of people right here. Let me first say hello to my old friend Mike Beyer. How you doing, man?
Good. It's great to be here.
It's great to see you too, man. Yeah. Congratulations on the play.
Thank you.
And Kim Bowler, I've never met you before, but I've seen you in a couple of shows.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All right.
And this is your first time directing.
This is not my first time directing. This is my first time directing a full length in Chicago.
Oh, I see. Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And Last Night in Karaoke Town, which is written by Mike Beyer and Kirk Pinchon, who is in L.A. Kirk, how you doing, buddy?
Nick, hi, man. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you, too, man. Congratulations on the show.
Thank you, sir. Hi, Kim and Mike, whatever.
Hi, Kirk.
Mike and Kirk go back a long ways. How long have you guys known each other? All the way back in Cleveland, right?
Yeah, I think high school.
High school.
Wow.
We met at probably 1985.
Yep. Wow, that's a long time. That's a long time. Spent a significant amount of time. You were with the Factory Theater, Kirk, for how many years?
About 4 years, and then I moved to L.A. many years ago, but have continued to kind of, they've been nice enough to let me dip my toe in every now and then when Mike and I have an idea for a play, and this is the latest.
Well, we're talking with members of the Factory Theater's production of Last Night in Karaoke Town. The Factory Theater is located at 1623 West Howard, right there in the heart of Rogers Park.
Right.
And how long have you guys been in that space now?
4 years.
Is it really? God, that time flies.
Isn't that crazy? I thought two, but I was corrected yesterday.
It feels longer.
4 years, yeah.
God, wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I mean, it just seems like yesterday you guys moved up there.
It's a great space.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nice to have a place that, you know, is your own and you're not renting or, like, you have to share space with anyone. It's good to be in charge.
Yeah, no, I know. I would say, I know. When we were up in Rogers Park on Loyola, that was beautiful.
Was.
That was our domain. And then, you know, then we moved over.
Yes,
we moved
our
over.
Crappy domain.
Yeah. It was our domain, though, man. It was a crappy little 60-seat house bathroom behind the stage.
Oh, no.
You had to actually walk through.
No.
Bathroom behind the stage.
Behind the stage.
I always forget that. You have to, people would have to go backstage to go to the can. It was just ridiculous.
We have two now.
Oh, my God.
We have two just for actors. One just for pooping.
Wow.
Strictly pooping.
We're big time now.
Yeah.
Oh,
luxury.
Man. Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
And a third, if you want to like use the coffee shops next door.
Yeah. So that's for the guests.
That's for the guests.
But it is a great space. I think it seats 65, so it's the same kind of...
Yeah, that's perfect.
And it's a great...
Is it three-quarter thrust?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a... Yeah, no, I mean, it's perfect space for you guys. Absolutely.
We've actually modified the space for this show.
Oh, okay.
We're doing alley style,
mm-hmm.
so we've taken out the center section and made that a part of the show.
Okay.
So that the audience sits on either side of the show.
Oh, that's cool.
As a more immersive element.
I remember the staging. Some of my favorite staging that the Factory did was when Matt Engel directed Incident. I mean, it put the subway like right in the middle, and you were on top. I saw the show twice. I got splattered with blood both times.
Ooh.
One of my all-time favorite shows.
It's a great show. I thought Engel directed the hell out of it, and the set was amazing.
Amazing. We got a Jeff for that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well-deserved.
Okay. Kirk, hang on. Kirk Pinchon is live from L.A. He and Mike co-wrote this play called The Last Night in Karaoke Town. We'll tell you all about it. It previews on the 14th. Officially, press opening is the 21st of February. And we'll continue to talk about it with my friends from the Factory Theater. Billy Joel. Nick DiGilio show continues right here on 720 WGN in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. Joining me live in studio is Mike Byer and Kim Bowler, co-writer and director of the new show, Last Night in Karaoke Town. And on the phone from L.A. is the other writer, Kirk Pinchon. Welcome.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Mike, tell me about... I always want to call you Beaver because it's your nickname.
There's no other name.
So tell us about where this came from. You can go first, and then Kirk, you can jump in.
Really, it's sort of a love letter to our hometown of Cleveland.
Mm.
It's set in a karaoke bar in a neighborhood in the city that is...
Is it based on a real place?
No.
Okay.
And the neighborhood's gentrifying. And the bar has been a karaoke bar for 30 years, a Cleveland institution, and it's been bought by a local bigwig who is going to turn the bar into a cider pub and bistro. And that's the essential conflict of the show.
Okay, Kirk, did the idea spring from both of you guys, or?
I think how it really started was I had mentioned to him about how, shockingly, all three of us aren't really into karaoke. I can't sing. Mike can sing, but I don't think he cares about karaoke. And Kim, if I'm not mistaken, you mentioned that you just straight up don't like it.
I'm allergic to it.
That's cute. Good yeah. choice to direct the show, then.
Yes.
Thank you.
So it's perfect for all of us. But I just had this idea of an idea about a karaoke play. And so I talked to Mike about it. And then just out of that general karaoke idea came, oh, let's set it in Cleveland and let's talk about our hometown and let's talk about how this bar kind of mirrors what's going on in Cleveland. And that's kind of how it steamrolled.
Oh, okay. Very, very cool. Now, what was the process like? Because you're in Chicago, Mike, and Kirk, you're obviously in Cleveland. Or, I'm sorry, L.A.
L.A.
What was it like to work? How did you write? Did you just send stuff back and forth through the computer and stuff like that?
No, we do things dumber than that.
That makes too much
we
sense.
We basically, which is, Nick, as you know, is pretty much par for the course for us.
Yeah.
We basically, quote-unquote, meet every Monday evening. So 6 o'clock on Monday, I'll get home from work. I'll call Mike. We'll BS for about a half hour about Cleveland sports teams and then about how we're old. And then we'll write for an hour. And then we just do that every Monday. And that's how we wrote this play. We kind of wrote it one Monday at a time because, you know, we both have careers and we both have families. And that's really all the time we had was just these Mondays.
Yeah.
So basically, actually, over the course of probably a year and a half, because it took that long over these Mondays, we wrote this play.
You just do it through Google Docs so you can see, yeah. You know, you see what he's typing, and
right.
I'll type something, he erases it.
Exactly. Then we argue and yell at each other, and through that we created this. And I think, honestly, if we're being honest, it's really, as much as we enjoy writing plays and have written plays in the past, it's just kind of this, it's kind of a way for us just to kind of hang out together, even though we're, you know, far apart.
That's really sweet.
Aww. Right. So it's last night in Karaoke Town, and it's the first ever tribute to Cleveland from the Factory Theater.
I mean, it has to be, right?
Yeah. How is it possible that it took this long for you guys to do a tribute to Cleveland?
You know, I don't know. I think the time was right.
Yeah. All right. So tell us about the play. And who's in it and all that stuff.
We have 12 actors. Wendy Hain, Ashley Yates, Jenna Ellis, Samantha Porter, Abby Warhouse, Sal Gatto, Gerby Gibson, Connor Clark, Michael Jones, Philip Zimmerman, Chase Wheaton Whirl, Tommy Bullington. And they're all in this bar interacting. I describe the bar as a junk drawer to Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea being that this bar has been around for 50, 60 years, and it's just literally collected everything through these generations. And the JJ, the original owner of the bar, who has since passed away, and his daughter Diana has taken over running it once he passed. Mm-hmm. She's become stuck, and she doesn't realize it yet. And when she's faced with this obstacle of the building being sold and this person coming in, and then she sees the patrons react to this news that the bar is closing down, she feels obligated to save it.
Mm-hmm.
And all these people want to save it so bad. And she eventually figures out that she needs to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, I mean, it is kind of a traditional factory show, and it's wacky, and there's a lot of bits and jokes.
And it's a shocker that there's a bar that, a show from the factory that takes place in a bar.
Yeah. That's one thing, right? What you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, right. How did I not write it? yeah, the Factory Theater knows a little bit about bars.
Yeah,
there's no question about it.
But it's got a bitter, not a bittersweet ending, but there is
I think it's bittersweet. Yeah. I absolutely think it's bittersweet. It's, no one ever likes to let go. Like, you find yourself, there's a line in the play that hits true for almost anybody at any age, is sometimes you're just running in place. You're doing the same old thing, and you don't know why you're unhappy. But then something happens, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I've just been doing the same thing over and over again. I've got to change. I've got to mix it up, do something different.
Yeah. It's called Last Night in Karaoke Town. Previews on the 14th, and it runs through the 28th of March at the Factory Theater, 1623 West Howard. You can call the box office at 866-811-4111. How long have you had that number? You've had that number forever, right?
I'm no longer in charge.
Oh, okay.
I've never heard of this number.
The Factory Theater.
It's a new number.
TheFactoryTheater.com. You can check it out. So, Kirk, what have you been doing in L.A.?
For the past 5 years, I came to LA, as most people do, to act and write, and well, that didn't work out. So as it happened, so I had to pivot. So for the past 5 or 6 years, I've been a managing editor of a small media company where we do videos and articles and lists and all that kind of fun internet meme stuff. And so, yeah, that's what I've been doing. And then, you know, family. And then the spare time, I decided to dedicate my life to my buyer.
you did that years ago, Kurt.
Nothing has changed.
I just vocalized it right now on live radio.
I see.
Good friend.
Yeah. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's the Nick DiGilio Show continuing here. We're talking about Last Night in Karaoke Town. Beef, how many plays have you written for The Factor? Can you count them? I directed a couple of them.
Yeah, written or co-written about, I'd say this is about my seventh or eighth one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we did you know, white trash, free pizza.
no, you do not have a play.
Yeah, that was his first one.
That was my first one. It was a sketch show. See, the bit is at Factory Theater at 8 o'clock, free pizza.
See?
Yeah.
Oh,
so the show did not do well.
It did not.
The show failed.
There were some very funny moments in it. My favorite is Set Your Alarm. That was my favorite. That was my favorite because my ex-wife was in that scene with you.
That's right.
oh my God!
Yeah. So no, it goes back a long ways. The first show that I directed was Free Pizza at the Factory,
right?
But the second show was White Trash, and Alive was the first show that I co-directed with Mike. But the first like freelance show that I did that I didn't write was White Trash, and that thing was a monster. It was a monster. I mean, we had that thing ran for years.
Mike Meredith, he said it best. We were going backstage, and he was like, it's like we're the Beatles. This is unbelievable. I mean, it was
sold out.
We filled that place.
It was packed every night, even in, you know, when we remounted it. Yeah. I came back and for the 20th season, and I didn't direct that. Oaken did the remount.
Yeah.
And that sold out.
Something about it.
I don't know what it was about that show. And I just remember you wrote it as a two act.
Yeah.
And I was like, you can't put an intermission in here because people are going to leave. I could.
And we've done the same thing in Karaoke Town.
Oh, is that right?
We have, instead of doing LaGrange, we have a medley of songs.
Oh, very cool.
And the idea was that there was going to be a costume change, but, you know, scripts change as they do. But the medley is staying. But the medley has stayed, and that is because of White Trash.
Well, what happened was it was originally written as a two-act, and I was like, this play is so stupid that... And so offensive. It's so offensive.
So offensive.
So, I mean, on every level. I mean, there's, yeah. I mean, it was the most offensive thing I've ever directed, and I've directed a lot of offensive stuff. And there were some people that would just sit in the audience and go, what am I listening to?
People would walk out.
Oh, there was like a vomit joke followed by a semen joke and followed by, you know, I mean, it was just ridiculous. And I was like, we can't. So we threw in a musical, like a karaoke thing.
Yeah.
And we threw in LaGrange. I picked LaGrange because it has no lyrics.
Nick and Oaken, they were hilarious.
Yeah, I was in the show for a while.
Hilarious. So,
but Kirk, now did you ever get into White Trash? You did, didn't you, a couple times?
I did. Well, we did it here in L.A.
Oh, that's right. You guys did it out in L.A. That's right.
Yeah, and it was a huge hit for us in L.A. We had the Factory Theater kind of satellite in L.A. for about, like maybe 4 years. And we did a bunch of, we did some new stuff, but we did a bunch of best of, and one of them was, of course, White Trash. And the same response here, people just loved it because it was just so outrageous and so friggin' stupid.
Well, it was,
people loved it.
I loved directing that show. I loved directing that show. And that was, I think I put a lot, I think my mark is all over that show.
It is. You know, it's funny because, I was, Kim and I were talking the other night, and I said, yeah, you know, last night Karaoke Town, kind of factory shows, they're kind of like dumb shows. And Kim said, I don't like it when you say that, you know, our shows are dumb. And I said, well, I don't think it's easy to do dumb shows well. I think a lot of craft goes into
that. I totally agree. All right. We're talking with Kirk Pinchon, who's in L.A., and Mike Beyer and Kim Bowler are live in studio. The show at the Factory Theater is called Last Night in Karaoke Town. Preview starting on the 14th, and it runs through the 28th of March. And you can go to 866-811-4111 for your tickets. And we'll talk more here on 720 WGN as the Nick DeGiglio Show continues. All right, the Nick DeGiglio Show continues here on a Monday night into Tuesday morning. Fran Capo is going to join us later on. She's a comedian, a motivational speaker. She has traveled around the world, and she's also the six-time world record holder for fastest talker. That's coming up. I'm sorry?
I want to meet her.
Yeah. It's going to be pretty amazing. Right now, though, live in studio, I have Mike Beyer and Kim Bowler. Kim directed it, and Mike Beyer co-wrote the show called Last Night in Karaoke Town with my old buddies of the Factory Theater. Kirk Pinchon is in L.A. He also co-wrote it as well. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
So let's talk about how much fun you're having directing this. You having a good time?
Yes. I have a really good cast. I've enjoyed working with the writers, both of them. We just have fun. It hasn't been stressful. It's just been a lot of fun trying to figure out who all these people are and make them not flat.
Yeah.
Not like caricatures. Like, yeah. For what you were saying, you know, the factory has a long history of throwing these characters up on stage that can come across as dumb and outlandish. This is, in my opinion, this is more... These characters are more grounded. These are more barflies.
Every once in a while, you know, the factory will do a show that's grounded in reality. A lot of shows have been grounded in reality. It's just that kind of known for the silliness. You know what I mean? That's over the years, because some of the factory theaters have been shows have been so outrageous that's right. What you remember. But stuff like Black and Blue was grounded in reality, and you know, stuff like that. Dirty Diamonds was grounded in reality.
Here Comes a Regular,
yeah. So
we haven't lost any silliness.
No.
There's definitely some silly characters. There's an argument over, in fact, one of the lines is, you know, we have serious conversations in this bar, and then the other says, you know what? Gary Cherone was not a better front man. That's the next line.
That's a reference to Van Halen.
Right.
That's a reference to Van Halen.
Don't give away the whole show.
I did.
The whole show's about Van Halen. That's the thing. Van Hagar.
Yes, right.
So the show is called Last Night in Karaoke Town. So Kirk, you... it's funny that you wrote this play about karaoke. Have you ever gone to karaoke?
I've gone to karaoke once in college. This was part of the impetus for this, is that I went to a karaoke night in college with my girlfriend because she was a singer, and she's like, we're going. And I was like, I guess we are. And so we had to sing, and she made me sing Endless Love with her, which was super awkward because I cannot sing. Yeah, it was very Brad Nevlin-like. And then there was a contest, and the winner won a free drink and a Miller Genuine Draft mirror. And that was the reward. And I happened to win because I just, like, sang Tina Turner, and I just, like, ran around the bar acting like an idiot I was an idiot. I won. And my girlfriend was so mad that I won. She was just pissed off.
That is hilarious.
So pissed off.
That is hilarious.
Because I won, and we ended up breaking up at the end of the semester.
Oh, there you go. At least you got the genuine draft mirror, though.
I got the genuine draft mirror, which is really all I wanted for that night.
Who won?
That's my extent of karaoke. Now, Mike can actually really sing, so I don't know if Mike's ever really done it.
Beav, have you done the karaoke?
You know, only when I've had to. I had to go for a work trip. And we were in Nashville, Tennessee, and my boss said, oh, we're going to go karaoke.
Oh, my God.
So it was country and western karaoke.
Oh, man.
But some of these people, like, they had worked out acts, like they had costumes, and they were not messing around. It was the real deal.
We used to go to, back in the day, when I was dating a lovely woman named Helena Kays, who was the artistic director of a great children's theater company called Barrel Monkeys, and they still perform. We used to go to Carol's every Monday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we used to go to Carol's every Monday. Carol's was the place, and you know, it was a blast. It was a real. I mean, I would need a few, a few cocktails in order to get up there.
I want to know what the deal is with karaokeing on a Monday night.
Yeah, well, it was Thursday night. Sorry, they performed on Monday. They performed. Barrel of Monkeys was on Monday nights at Neo Futurarium.
Because the show is set
the show
on
takes
a...
place on a Monday night.
Yeah.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's a good drinking night.
Absolutely.
Of course. Back in my day, every night was a good drinking night.
Right. I think the idea of it is kind of like how club kids, like at least back in the day, club kids would like go to clubs on Monday or Tuesday nights, but not Friday or Saturday nights because those were the not cool nights. So the hardcore people go on the off nights. That's kind of the thing where I was thinking.
We used to, you know, they just celebrated.
They're hardcore, so they go Monday.
They just celebrated an anniversary of this juice bar called Medusa's, which was Belmont and Sheffield, near Belmont and Sheffield, and it was like sort of the goth teen juice bar, and people would go there all the time. Incredibly popular. Incredibly popular. You know who would play at Medusa's every once in a while?
Who?
G.G. Allin.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
The insane Gigi Allen. Are you familiar with Gigi Allen?
Yeah.
Weird.
Gigi Allen.
That is weird.
There's a movie.
At Medusa's?
At Medusa's. He would play at Medusa's. I'm not making this up.
Yeah.
What's the name of the documentary? Hated? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, the one by Todd Phillips?
Yeah, the one about Gigi
Allen. Hated Gigi Allen. Yeah.
If you want to, I mean, this guy was insane. Gigi Allen was nuts. He would get up on stage. He would get up on stage and like take his clothes off and defecate on the stage and throw it at the audience. He was nuts. He was absolutely nuts. He said he was going to kill himself on stage. He was going to kill himself like on Halloween on stage, and people would go and see this guy. Like they would actually pay to see him. And I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again. I know you don't know who he is, but Gigi Allen, like I said, was a lunatic. And he was doing a sound check at Lounge Axe, this old bar on Lincoln Avenue, which is now Lincoln Hall, mm-hmm. that used to be Lounge Axe, which is a legendary place. So I've told this story before, but you've heard this, right?
I think so.
Okay, so he's at the sound check. This is like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and he's wasted. Okay, so he shows up at the sound check. The sound guy's not happy, as most sound guys are. That's like, sound guys are just like... I got to deal with these idiots, you know. So the guy's he's late. So the sound guy's already, you know, infuriated. He shows up loaded, okay? And they're going through the sound check, and so he takes off all his clothes. Gigi Allen takes off all his clothes. He grabs a tray full of glasses and he shatters them on the floor in front of the stage, like broken shards of glass everywhere. Jumps up on top of the Marshall stack, the speaker, takes the microphone that he has, sticks it up his butt. Jumps off the Marshall speaker and lands into the glass. And now he's laying in the glass, naked, mic up his butt, bleeding all over the place. The sound man, without a beat, gets out of the booth, walks up to him and says, "You just bought that effing microphone." So he doesn't care. You know, he doesn't care. The guy's bleeding all over the place. He was so mad. He's a sound guy. You don't do that to a microphone.
That's how you get pink eye.
Yeah. So. But now, as the story, the legend continues. They kept that microphone. It was the Gigi Allen microphone. And whenever somebody gave them a hard time in sound check, they would switch out the microphone.
That's funny.
They would get the Gigi Allen microphone.
That's good.
So, but yeah, he used to play at Medusa's. So yeah, and that was Monday an off. Night. It's one of those off nights. So Monday night. What's Monday night like at a bar in Cleveland?
It's empty.
It's empty.
Yeah.
But I think I think that they come there and it is kind of a world. You know, we have two characters that are fighting over who gets to sing the song "Torn" by Natalie and Bruglia, and I mean this is a cat fight. And they got their seconds, and yeah. they're going to throw down if she gets up and sings "Torn."
Yeah. Now, do you guys actually have karaoke in the show? Are people singing songs and all that stuff?
Yeah.
We actually have. I have playwrights who decided to write a karaoke show where there's karaokeing happening as well as a scene at the same time. Thank you. Thank you, Kirk and Beef.
Kim is a fantastic director who has done a brilliant job.
Oh, that's cool.
It's true.
I'm grabbing him by the neck right now. That's why I'm saying.
Well, did you...
In our defense, at the time we were writing it, we didn't even think of that. We were like, yeah, it's fine.
I know that. I know that, Kirk.
They'll figure it out.
Yeah. Someone will figure it out. That's not us.
Yeah, we're not directing it. We just wrote it. We're done.
Right.
Yeah, we just wrote it. They'll figure it out.
It's Nick DiGilio show continuing here on 720 WGN. The Factory Theater presents Last Night in Karaoke Town. The writers are with us, Mike Byer and Kirk Pinchon, and the director, Kim Bowler. Great stuff at the Factory Theater. And I want to talk a little bit more about what's going on with the Factory. I've been going for a long time.
I've
been going a while. But last time I worked with you guys was when we did Black and Blue. And that was 2011.
What? Really?
Yeah. 2011.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Long time.
We will continue this conversation right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio show continues right here on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. I'm very happy to have with me from the Factory Theater in studio, Mike Byer and Kim Bowler. And on the phone, my old friend Kirk Pinchon. Kirk and Mike wrote Last Night in Karaoke Town, and Kim directed it. It previews on the 14th, and it runs through March 28th with the press opening on the 21st at the Factory Theater at 1623 West Howard. We were talking off the air about terrible karaoke songs. My producer, Tom Hush, you ever gone karaoke? Do you do the karaoke?
I used to go every single Sunday night when I worked at the new 400 Theater in Rogers Park.
Nice.
And it was the best. My go-tos were Joy Division's Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Did you do the voice?
Ooh, oh, yeah, I did the voice, and I would gyrate. You know,
that is awesome.
And then do a little David Allan Coe, You Never Even Call Me By My Name.
Oh, man. Wow, those were your go-tos. Whenever we went to Carol's, you know what my go-to was?
What?
Higher by Creed. I would do the Jesus pose. Wow. And yeah. By the way, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. So what are some of the, terrible songs that you, I don't want to give everything away, but there are some terrible songs in the show?
There are. I mean,
Peter Cetera and Amy Grant.
The Next Time I Fall in Love.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. We got to do a ballad.
Oh.
So, you got to have the ballad. That's required.
We used to have a guy, you know, one of the guys that would show up.
I'd say that is the worst out of all the shows in the song.
I love that song.
That is my
That's
least favorite.
My favorite song.
Songs in the show. That's your favorite?
Good. It's a good thing to play. It's a good
Shut
thing,
up, Kirk.
It's a good thing the playwright gets along with the director. That's how it always works.
Yeah.
We used to have a guy when we went to back in the day when we went to Carol's. There was a guy who clearly Thursday nights was the night that he looked forward to every week. Like this was his night. So he came in and he had a collection. You know those T-shirts with wolves on them?
Yes.
Where the wolf takes up the whole shirt.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Trees, a forest, and a wolf, and a moon. This guy had a collection of those, and he would have them tucked into his jeans. And he came in, and oh man, what was his signature song? But now I can't remember his signature song. I can't believe I can't remember this. But anyway, he would come in, and people started to go nuts over this guy because like people would just start cheering. This guy, because he really belted it out. I mean, he really was. I'm trying to remember. Oh,
Hungry Like a Wolf?
No.
Werewolves of London.
His power move was he'd do moves on the there wasn't a stage. It was on the floor at Carol's. So there it's right there. And so, but his big move would be to push the monitor away.
Because
he doesn't need it. That was his big power move. He'd push the monitor. God, I wish I could remember what the song was that he sang. That was like the big song, and everybody would go nuts. Like they would just buy. And that guy never bought a beer.
Yeah,
there's something magical about karaokeing. There's this beautiful cultness to it where you could be nobody.
Yeah,
but. In that moment when you're singing that song, you are a superstar. And I think that's part of the appeal of some of these characters in the show is that they don't have any place else to go where they feel like this.
Yeah. That's important. I think that's great.
There's a guy in Nashville. I mean, this guy was about this tall.
It's radio. How tall?
Or he was about 5 feet tall. Yeah.
That was like my first 3 feet.
I put my hand way down. First time
Classic
on radio.
Mike Meyer.
Beaving it.
Just radio superstar.
I just beaved it. It was this little guy, and he had a huge cowboy hat, and he walked up and sang that song, Tennessee Whiskey by Chris Stapleton, and...
Superstar. Yeah.
Superstar.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. God, I can't believe I can't remember what this guy's signature song was. And he would kill it. He would just kill it every week. And he would do two or three... He would go up there two or three times with the one signature song. That he used to do, and everybody would go nuts.
We did karaoke at the factory launch party, and Oaken got up.
Scott Oaken
got up and sang Two Out of Three Ain't Bad.
Oh, well, Scott can sing. That's the thing. Scott can sing.
He did great.
And he loves the meatloaf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He killed it.
Scott, former roommate of mine, one of my best friends, and former artistic director of the factory theater. He took over after I left.
Yeah,
good for him, man. Yeah. So, and he had a good run. It's Manny now, right? And Stacey?
Yeah, Scott just stepped down.
But he's still, I mean, he just did a play of his.
Very much so, yeah.
He hasn't left us.
No, of course
he's
not.
He's just not in charge anymore.
He doesn't want to be in charge. He was in charge for a long time. Aww. I think he's got the longest reign as artistic director of the Factory Theater.
I think so. I think that's right.
For sure. I think,
he will never have to take out the garbage again.
No. No, he won't. Oh, God, please. cleaning up that space.
No, he yeah, he just did the It's Haunted.
Yeah, you can't say the name
of the
show.
I can't say the full name of the show, but
so,
it was excellent.
Yeah.
Really
fun. Hey, Kirk, how's Jesse? Jesse's an old friend, Jesse Dienstag.
Jesse Dienstag is back in the Chicago area.
Yep. Oh, that's right. That's
yeah,
right.
He's been there for a long time. So, yeah, he moved his family there, wow, probably like 7 or 8 years ago.
I totally
ago.
Forgot about that. Although, yeah, he's been here for a while.
Shockingly, you guys don't know this, but I'm trying to see if I can go to this. This Friday night is a old school Factory Theater reunion because Jenny and Miles Laffey are coming to L.A. for the weekend.
These are all old school members of the Factory Theater. Jesse
like
Dienstag,
early '90s all stars.
Yeah.
Cynthia Savini, Mike Meredith, Pat, Sean Atwood, all the old school are getting together with Brooke Dillman, Friday night.
Brooke Dillman, it's amazing to me that she's not a megastar.
She was.
Brooke Dillman is, without question, the funniest woman I've ever directed.
Yeah.
And the funniest woman I've ever done scenes with. Because we did this, we did a play that was a takeoff of Escape from New York. It was a holiday show, and it was called Escape from the North Pole. And I played Snake Plissken in it. And she had the Lee Van Cleef role from it. And I had to do a scene with her, and I could barely, I just couldn't, I can't even, she's one of the funniest women I've ever
she's
seen
like,
in my
look
life.
At all these buttons and lights.
Oh, my God. Like, she's so funny.
Those are impressive, yes.
And she has done some stuff. She did some TV work. She's in Superbad.
She's done a lot of TV work. She finished the 3 seasons of that TV show Wrecked on TV.
Oh, that's right. She's on Wrecked.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't know who this is, Brooke Dillman, I mean, really, truly, genius funny. Like, genius level comedy.
Oh, yeah, next level.
Yeah, I mean, she's just, it's unbelievable what she does.
She worked on Disney and did some sitcoms, you know, the sitcoms that the kids can watch.
Right.
And,
yeah, she did a lot of Disney sitcoms. Good Luck Charlie.
She's the science teacher in Superbad.
Yeah.
Like, she's got a couple of scenes in Superbad, and she's hilarious. Hilarious.
She was on The Office, right? She had a scene with Carell?
Yeah, she had a small scene in The Office. Yep.
Yeah.
She works. Yeah, she's great. So these are all old Factory members that we're just reminiscing about here.
And Jenny Laffey is not far behind Brooke Dillman.
No, she's
Jenny
hilarious.
Jenny Laffey is
she's hilarious.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to direct her and Brooke and Cynthia and Molly Brennan and
what was that show called?
Rapid Fire.
Rapid Fire.
Why am I blanking on Peter Marcy's wife?
Michelle Sufferton.
Yeah, and that was one of my favorite experiences ever. Was
great
directing.
Show.
It was all women and me.
Brooke
was genius in that show.
Yeah,
like ridiculously funny. A lot of talented people that come through the doors at the Factory Theater. What's going on at the Factory? What's coming up after? I know we haven't even opened this show yet, but what's been going on at the Factory?
Well, our next show for the summer is HOA. It was written by Angelina Martinez,
mm-hmm.
which is Eric Roach's
wife. Yeah, mm-hmm. She's a lovely woman.
And she's written a really nice, dark comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's
Who's directing it?
I believe it's Christy Arrington. The director, I believe.
Okay.
And
you know, it's funny that you guys continue this tradition of, like, really strong female voices at the Factory Theater. I think that's something that you guys should be proud of. And it's historically, you know, even when I was with the company, you know, years ago, the females they kicked ass and they're well represented. And I mean, look, you got a female director, female playwright, you know, in the next one. And Beav, you're a female.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's great. Not only just in the acting department, but you know, directing and writing. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's something the Factory has always done well.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Kirk, you working on anything writing wise besides this?
Oh yeah, Mike and I already have our next play that we are writing, which we started writing late last year, and we'll probably as soon as the play opens, we'll start it up again. We're keeping it tightly under wraps. But I can tell you this, it involves a boy band.
Oh, please.
You need to write the Ted and Miles Last Night in Karaoke Town.
Why am I not surprised that you guys are going to write a play about a boy band? It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. Why haven't we written one before?
Shocked. Kirk, it was great to talk to you, man. Best of luck, okay?
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Man.
Appreciate all your support.
Sure thing,
and keep doing the God's work.
All right, buddy. Kirk Pinchon, co-writer. Nice to talk to Kirk.
Yeah.
Good to see you too, Mike.
Thank you. Good to see you.
It's great to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Really nice to meet you, Kim.
It's good to meet you.
And break 900 legs.
Thank you.
The show opens, well, it previews on the 14th, officially opens on the 21st of February. It runs through March 28th. Last Night in Karaoke Town. Check out thefactorytheater.com for more information. Thanks again, you guys.
Thank you very much.
All right. The Nick DiGilio Show continues.
Some luck in my direction. I caught it in my hands today. I finally made a tricky French connection. You winked and gave me your okay. I'll take you on a trip beside the ocean and drop the top of Chesapeake Bay. Ain't nothing like the sky to dose a potion. The moon will send you on your way. Back and observe the constellations and watch the moon smiling bright. I'll play the radio on southern stations, 'cause southern bells are hell at night. You say you came to Baltimore from Ole Miss, a class of 7-4 gold ring. The eastern moon looks ready for
720 WGN, you are listening to The Nick DiGilio Show. I am the producer, Tom Hush. Nick DiGilio is out tonight, sick. We wish him well. He is in bed recovering and getting ready to come on back and get back to the show as usual. But for tonight, we're playing back some of our favorite bits, favorite interviews from the last couple of weeks. Right here, we're going to listen to a conversation Nick had with Annie Wilder, who's an author of many books. Her latest is called Trucker Ghost Stories. She likes to work in the paranormal and gather stories from people who are out there on the open road, the things that they see, the things that they experience. This one's from about a week and a half ago. Really interesting conversation between her and Nick, so get ready to listen to that. Again, Nick is out sick tonight, so we are listening back to some of our favorite interviews he's done over the last few weeks. Again, this is Annie Wilder, author of Trucker Ghost Stories, here on 720 WGN.
Right now, let's talk to Annie Wilder. She is the author of three popular true ghost story books. Her latest book is called Trucker Ghost Stories. And we know we have a lot of truckers who listen to this show, and I wonder if they've ever had a little paranormal moment. But Annie's the author, and let's say hello. Hello, Annie.
Hi, Nick. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, sure. Of course. Of course. When did you, have you always been interested in the paranormal? How long has that been around?
Yeah, I have been. And I think partly because I was raised Catholic. And so growing up, all the people that I looked up to and respected, my parents and my grandparents and my teachers at the Catholic school, talked about a world of spirits and saints, and there were ways to communicate through prayers and novenas and petitions, and it just seemed like the spirit world was this interesting place that had its own rules and mores, I guess, its own culture.
Yeah.
And then I was very lucky to have my parents are awesome. My dad passed away in 2018, but he was a Montana farmer. And my mom was St. Paul raised. And so my dad kind of instilled in us the love of the outdoors and nature and hard work. And my mom, who also worked very hard, kind of, you know, instilled in us a love of reading and books and dreams and art and mystical things. We talked about our dreams. My mom's mom was Irish, and she talked to us kids about fairies and leprechauns and the death knock and magic and all sorts of cool things. So, yes, from the time I've been a small child, I have been very interested in the spirit world.
It seems like the path was laid out for you at a very young age, Annie.
Yeah, I feel lucky. I feel like I got the best of both worlds, like a grounded hard work ethic and sense of decency, and yet a real awareness of an interest in the invisible world as well.
What was your what was your first encounter with a paranormal encounter?
Well, when I was very young, age 7 or younger, and actually throughout my life, but the first thing that I remember seeing was yellow eyes watching me at night.
Oh.
And they looked like animal eyes, not human eyes, but these kind of elongated yellow eyes.
Oh.
And I could see them. Yeah, it was spooky, but then nothing ever happened, and nothing bad ever happened, so it just became something that I was aware of. And I did see two ghosts when I was a little kid. One was at my grandparents' house, and I was upstairs brushing my teeth and getting ready for bed, and my sister was also staying at my grandparents' house, and they had like 5 bedrooms upstairs in this long hallway that kind of was like a horseshoe shape. And the bathroom door was partly ajar, and I was brushing my teeth, and I saw who I thought was my sister running past with a white nightgown on, just like, past the door. Mm. And I yelled her name out because it scared me. And then when she didn't answer, I got this really bad feeling, hot, you know, just like, bleh. And I looked out, and there was nobody out there, and I ran downstairs, and she was sitting in the living room with my grandparents eating ice cream and watching Johnny Carson.
Oh, man.
I'm like, ooh, not in pajamas. So that was one ghost. And then I saw another when I was 8 or 9, when we lived out in the Black Hills. And that was a spirit that took the shape of like the outline of a man floating in the hallway. And I was home alone, which is pretty weird because I have 7 brothers and sisters. And I was just sick that day. So my mom had gone into town to pick up the other kids from school. And when I saw the man, I ran outside and held on to our dog, you know, for protection until my mom got home.
Yeah. Wow. Right. Annie Wilder, we continue this conversation. She is the author of 3 popular true ghost story books, lives in a haunted house, which we will discuss, and also the latest book is called Trucker Ghost Stories. If you've had a paranormal event, or if you're a trucker and you've dealt with some paranormal stuff or ghosts on the dark highways and byways, we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. The Nick DiGilio Show continues right here on 720 WGN.
Chugging, got my chips cashed in. Keep chugging like the doodah man together. More or less in
Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN. Tom just picked a very clever bump because not only is it about trucking, it's by the Grateful Dead. So that covers both things. Annie Wilder is the author of 3 popular true ghost story books. Her third book is called Trucker Ghost Stories. Annie, how often do you have people tell you about their experiences?
All the time.
Yeah.
That's one of the benefits of writing books there. I used to work at Llewellyn Publishing, and so they publish a lot of books on metaphysical and paranormal things. So, yeah, it's one of the things that makes my life fun and interesting. I hear so many stories. I actually had to just kind of narrow down, trying to just get a few to tell you tonight from the Trucker Ghost Story book because there's so many stories, but I have some lined up whenever you're ready.
Oh, you know,
so.
I'd love to hear. We will. We'll definitely get into that. And if anybody has some paranormal stories that they want to share with us, it's 312-981-7200. And all of our, you know, because of the hours that I'm on the air, Annie, I do have a lot of truckers who listen to the show. You know, because
that's so cool.
Because they drive through, you know, the late night and into the morning, and so they listen to the show. And if anybody's had those kind of experience, before we jump into, you know, some of your stories from the Trucker Ghost Story book, there's a legendary local ghost here in the Chicago area named Resurrection Mary. Have you ever heard of Resurrection Mary?
I have. We actually have a story about Resurrection Mary in the book.
Well,
I would like to hear. I would like to hear. It's in the legends and lore section of the book, but I would love to hear your take on it.
Well, it's such a it's such a legendary ghost. Every year around Halloween, I've been hosting a radio show now for over 20 years, and every year around Halloween, the Resurrection Mary story comes up, and everybody talks about it. It's near Resurrection Cemetery. I'm trying to remember. Tom, can you look up what suburb that is? I should know this. We've only talked about this a thousand times.
Willow Springs.
It was Willow Springs. Okay. And so the reports are that there are people who drive down, usually guys who drive are driving down, and they see this woman who's like in a prom dress. Looking for a ride, and they let her in, and then she disappears when they get to a certain part near Resurrection Cemetery, and sometimes leaves a puddle. Sometimes leaves a puddle of water on the seat. She always gets in the back seat and doesn't say anything, and leaves a puddle of water and never says a word. Like she's in the car and it's eerily silent. And then the rumor is that she died in a car accident on that stretch of road and hitchhikes and is still looking for a way to get home. That's the story. And it is, you've included it in your book, Annie, but here locally, it's one that we talk about all the time.
That's so cool. Well, I think that these legends must meet some need in us. And I actually am open-minded about the spirit world. I believe that there are lots of ways that the spirit world and just different dimensions are interesting places that there's some cross-communication among us. But the point about the puddle of water, I think, is really interesting. I can't remember if that was in the story that's in my book, that particular point. But I mean, when you think about, you've heard about poltergeists, and one of the ways that they manifest or make their presence known is a puddle of water. Mm. So that's kind of an interesting twist on it.
Yeah.
It's just a form of spirit energy.
You know, how often, here's a question for you, Annie, because I've heard the Resurrection Mary story, I can't tell you how many times over the years, and sometimes details are different. Sometimes they change. How do these stories morph? Because when you tell a story or a legend over the course of a long time, over many years, some people just add details that weren't there before. How often do you have to go back and check to see if these stories have morphed into something different?
Oh, my gosh. All the time. In fact, with my own, my second book was a book of true family ghost stories, and I have a family that writes down, we have written down stories. I had stories that were back from 150 years ago. And even with that, if I ask three different people, so what was the thing where great grandma met great grandpa back in the 1870s and blah, blah, blah. And everyone will have a slightly different version of it, because I think that's just how human memory works. And some things meant more to some people, and some people thought something happened. And it's part of the challenge and the fun of sorting out a story. I have actually I just want to pop in one of my favorite stories in the book is also a vanishing hitchhiker story.
Okay.
It was contributed by Christopher O'Brien, and he lived out in the San Luis Valley in Colorado for many years. Mm-hmm. And wrote a bunch of books, and I think he's got a radio show or a podcast out. But he did a bunch of investigating. This is when that cattle mutilations and animal mutilations were really going on. And I have my dad's cousin lives out there right by the UFO watchtower, actually.
Uh-huh.
And we have been out there, and there are weird things going on in the sky all the time. But anyway, so Christopher O'Brien's story was that it's called Hitchhiker in Red. Yeah, Hitchhiker in Red. But he was investigating cattle mutilations, and he was talking to a local police officer, police chief from one of the towns, and he asked if he had any other, if there were other things going on. And he said the police chief was hesitated and then said, well, yes, he said, my uncle had a weird experience that he insisted on filing a police report, and we really discouraged him. We didn't want him to do it, but he did, so it's public record. But anyway, the uncle, and he said his uncle was a sober man, hardworking, responsible.
Yeah.
he was driving home late one night, and there was a woman walking along the road in a red dress, and he stopped to give her a ride because she was out in the middle of nowhere. And same kind of thing, she got in the truck, and he had a bench seat in his pickup truck, and she just sat down and stared straight ahead and didn't say anything. And he was just starting to ask her, the uncle, why she was out so late at night. And it was then that he noticed, and this is a quote, that she had cloven hooves and goat's legs.
Oh, man.
And then she just, I don't know, just, oh, isn't that odd? Just so spooky. Oh, my gosh. That one just killed me. It was so good.
Yeah.
And then she dematerialized, which I guess I would want the person to
at
that point.
Yeah. Like, oh, that's creepy. That is creepy. Annie Wilder is the author of very popular true ghost story books, including the new one, which is Trucker Ghost Stories. And we're hearing a lot of fun ghost stories here. And if you would like to join us, it's 312-981-7200. We did get a text in from a listener, Annie.
Cool.
Tom says, what's Annie's take on TV shows like Ghost Adventures and other shows like it? Do they seem real or are they staged?
I think that they are at their core real.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Ghost Adventures. I guess maybe I've seen a few episodes. We kind of didn't have cable at the time that that one came out. I used to watch Paranormal State all the time. I loved that show.
Yeah.
And my friend Dave Schrader is on a new paranormal show, and he will want to kick my butt for not remembering the name of it. But Dave Schrader is on a new paranormal show, and he's a really talented guy. But I think that my impression is that they are really doing actual work, and that there really is something going on in the places that they go to. I do know that when people are filming TV shows, they're looking for dramatic, you know, happenings. I don't think that they probably fake stuff, but I think that editing is done and stuff in a way to get the most dramatic impact, and that's part of the nature of a TV show.
Yeah.
And it seems to work.
His show is called The Holzer Files.
Thank you. Gosh, yeah. David, The Holzer Files.
The Holzer Files. That's it. Yeah.
I can tell you that I get contacted by TV producers quite often. And one of my hopes for Trucker Ghost Stories was that it would get turned into a TV show. And after pursuing it with three different production companies, and getting to various stages in the process that then fell apart, I just was like, I'm going to wait till somebody comes to me. And just let it go. But I do know from talking to different producers and to camera crew who worked with a show that was very popular, that both the producer that I've spoken with and somebody who was well known on one of the shows ended up with real life paranormal attachments or problems, you know, activity that followed them home. So,
okay,
that, as I understand, they were able to deal with. But so it is real, and I think that it's good to have a healthy respect for the astral realm.
Got it. Annie Wilder. We're chatting with Annie Wilder. She is the author of three popular true ghost story books. Her latest is called Trucker Ghost Stories. She's got more really spooky stories to tell. And if you have any paranormal stories, if you're a trucker, 312-981-7200. And Nick DiGilio Show continues on 720 WGN. Annie Wilder is the author of many books, including Trucker Ghost Stories. Annie, what do you think it is about why people are the roadways are prone to some of these paranormal experiences? Because there are so many stories that are paranormally related that happen on the road, and especially on the dark, you know, like highways.
Yeah, that's exactly why I wanted Truckers. I thought that would be such a cool mashup of paranormal and like the uber masculine profession, but
yeah.
Also like they're the ones who are out there, you know.
And yeah, yeah.
It's just like if you go on YouTube or check out these things, the what do they call them? Trail cams that hunters use.
Yeah,
that's catching a lot of stuff too. It's like that's very cool. I mean, that was unexpected. I think part of it is because it's nighttime. I think part of it is because when you're driving, a lot of times you're in somewhat of an altered state anyway, like you're in a kind of a beta state rather than an alpha state. Wait, am I getting that mixed up? Let's see. I actually looked it up. Yeah, no, you drive in an alpha state. So beta is the normal consciousness, and then alpha is the one that's a little more relaxed,
right.
And theta. And if you're driving like tons and tons of hours, I've done it only a few times, but it's really easy to get into a very altered state, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that it is possible, I'm not a scientist, but I think that it is possible that when we're in altered states, it's not only that we are hallucinating. I think that we might just be able to, we might have the ability to perceive things that we otherwise don't perceive.
Right, right. And, and so a lot of these truckers are out there driving 30, 40 hours at a crack. You know what I mean?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah,
yeah,
I can't even imagine. Well, they talk about white line fever and what's the other one, like driving hypnosis or, so that's what I think. I think that those are factors that contribute to people having these experiences at night.
Yeah.
A lot of the stories in my book take place at night. And by the way, it was so much fun to get these stories and gather these stories. And I have a huge respect for truckers. I dedicated my book to a trucker that I knew when I was a grade school kid, I guess junior high.
Mm.
I worked for my dad. He was the manager of a sand plant. And so I would make, in the summer times, I would type invoices and make coffee and sweep the floor. And so one of these truckers was named Bill Sykes, and he told me a really good ghost story. And so I dedicated my book to him. I tried to get in touch with him, but unfortunately he had passed away by the time my book came out. But yeah, so, I've talked so much, I forgot your original question.
No, that's okay. You already answered it, and we have another text that's come in from the 224 area code. It says, "Hi, I'm a security officer and worked many haunted hotels, but the one I remember, I was sitting in the hallway of a hotel, and my chair started spinning. There was no breeze or air blowing. I ran down the stairs, told the maintenance man to go upstairs. He sat in the chair. It started spinning one way and then another. He jumped out of the chair and ran down the stairs and quit."
Right. Yes. Smart guy.
Yeah. That's
yeah.
It. Quit.
There's so much weird stuff. That's why I like it when people talk about it. And I actually love when regular, ordinary people tell their weird experiences.
Yeah. Annie Wilder is who we're talking to. Her latest book is called Trucker Ghost Stories. 312-981-7200. Here's Big Ed. Go ahead, Ed.
Hey, Nick. Annie. I just want to say something. I don't talk about this very much, but I don't know if this is in your topic, but I was in bed one night, and I was pretty sick. And honest to God, I think I was dying. And I was going down this long tube, and I see this hand comes up and says, "Not yet." And when I heard that, "Not yet," immediately woke up, and I was like, "All right, what's going on here? What happened?" It was the weirdest thing. Honestly, God, it was the weirdest thing.
So it was kind of like someone telling you that you shouldn't die yet, even though you were very, very sick at the time. That's fat. You, Annie,
yeah.
you've talked about near death experiences, I'm assuming, in some of your stories.
Yeah, actually, my Uncle Jim, who lives out on the Montana border, got electrocuted on a job site. The guy who was right next to him was carrying a ladder that he walked into a power line.
Oh.
And my uncle got electrocuted. He flew, and actually,
paramedics or somebody said the only reason he probably lived is because he hit a beam so hard that it restarted his heart.
Oh.
It blew a hole out of his of the bottom of his foot. But he woke up and he said he did feel like he was in a tunnel, and he saw spirits. He couldn't identify who they were, but he saw spirits around.
Yeah.
And then he said, just like a steak that's underdone at a restaurant, he got sent back.
That's how he put it, right?
Yeah, that's how he put it. He's a pretty funny guy. And then he said when he came to and he saw all these guys from the crew standing around looking at him, he said, which one I can... I don't know if we can cuss a little bit on this show or shouldn't, but which one of you son of SOBs?
Yeah.
Which one of you SOBs gave me CPR?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, nobody did. We thought you were dead.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, but it was the fact that he hit the steel beam with so much force that his heart restarted.
That's a crazy story.
So it sounds like Ed may have had the same... Kind of
experience.
Near-death experience, yeah.
We're talking with Annie Wilder. His latest book is called Trucker Ghost Stories here on 720 WGN. It's the Nick DeGilio Show, 312-981-7200. Here's another local haunted story here, Annie. And my details around this one are a little bit more fuzzy. But Danny, a listener, texted in, has Annie ever heard of Bachelor's Grove in Midlothian, Illinois, off of the Turnpike?
No.
Bachelor's Grove... Tom, can you Google this and we can get a few more details so that we can tell Annie about it? Once again, Annie, when we do talk about ghost stories, local ghost stories here in the Illinois Chicagoland area, Bachelor's Grove comes up a lot. It's supposedly one of the most haunted places in Illinois. Lots of really creepy and scary stories have come out of Bachelor's Grove. Tom, did you get any info about the haunted Bachelor's Grove?
Yeah, so Bachelor's Grove goes back to about the 1800s, a little early 1800s, and many strange things have been reported there, such as floating orbs of light, phantom vehicles, mysterious black dogs that appear and then disappear, and it's often been reported that it was a dumping ground for victims of the Chicago crime syndicate, so people like Al Capone.
There's a lot
of bad things have gone down in Bachelor's Grove, Illinois.
Yeah, Bachelor's Grove, Illinois. Every time we talk about local haunted spots, Bachelor's Grove comes up like near the top of the list. You should read up on that one, Annie. I think you'd really love some of the stories. Yeah.
I just made a note of it. Yeah. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of Adam Seltzer.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So he does ghost tours in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and I know of him. I don't think I ever met him, but he wrote a book that we published when I worked at Llewellyn called Ghosts of Chicago. Ghosts of Chicago. Yeah. So, no, I can't believe that I haven't heard of Bachelor's Grove.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's something to check out.
For sure.
We are going to be going down to a small town in Illinois later this summer. It's where my husband grew up.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we'll have to take a swing through.
Yeah.
If I can convince him.
Bachelor's Grove, Midlothian, Illinois. Okay, Annie Wilder is the guest. We continue our conversation at 720 WGN, the Nick DeGilio Show on 720 WGN.
720 WGN, you're listening to the Nick DeGilio Show. Nick is out sick tonight. I am his producer, Tom Hush. And we are playing back some of his best interviews of the last couple weeks, keeping you all caught up with everything that's happened over the last couple weeks since he's out sick. If you want to send him any of your well wishes, you can send an email over to nickdshow@gmail.com. Same place you send all your submissions for, the Friday features and, things like You Big Dummy and Straight Out of Context, Nick D Show Spies. Feel free to send him a nice little well wish, and I'll make sure that he gets those. Right now, we're listening to an interview with Nick and Annie Wilder. Annie Wilder is a author, and she has written 3 books on the paranormal, collects stories of people who have experienced strange things out on the American roadways. This one's called Trucker Ghost Stories. Really interesting one. This was from about a week and a half ago. Yeah. Annie Wilder is her name again, and we'll catch the last bit here before we go to the newsroom for the 1 o'clock news, 312-981-7200. Again, this is the Nick D Show, Nick DiGilio Show. Nick is out sick tonight. We send him our best. Hope he's in bed recovering. And I'm his producer, Tom Hush, playing back some of his interviews from the past couple weeks, keeping you caught up so that when he comes back, it's all new stuff from then on. All right. So here we go. More with Annie Wilder and Nick DiGilio.
I lit up from Reno, I was trailed by 20 hands. Didn't get to sleep that night till the morning came around. Sit out from
The Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN. We are talking with Annie Wilder. And Annie, your latest book is called Trucker Ghost Stories. And you told us one that was pretty creepy. Can you share a couple of more?
Sure. Okay, so here's another. There's so many good stories in this book, but I just pulled a few out. So
okay.
This one is called Soldier Ghost in Texas, and it's by Barb Dexter, and she was, her husband, now ex-husband, was a trucker, and they were going through Texas, and they were out in the middle of nowhere, and he didn't like to pay for a hotel, so they always just pulled over and slept in the truck, and she said they were in the truck and sleeping, and it was like somebody started, first I think they heard knocks on the truck, and he got out, shone his flashlight out and whatever, and then the truck started rocking like somebody was pushing it, and he jumped out and had his gun, I guess, and a flashlight, and then he said, "Hey, can you come out here? See if you hear this." And she came out, and they were in the middle of nowhere, and you could see that there was nothing. There was a woods a little ways away.
Yeah.
But they heard what sounded like people talking in the distance, but they couldn't see anything like tents or a campfire or lights. And so they walked. You know, he's like, I want to see what this is. So they walked. She didn't want to go towards the voices, but she didn't want to stay alone in the truck either.
Sure, sure.
So she walked with them, and she said as they got closer, the voices were sounding like they were coming from different places. Like some were, they thought they were walking toward the voices, and all of a sudden they seemed like they were someplace else. And then they seemed like they're over here, and that was weird. And then when they, at some point, they realized that it wasn't the sound of, like, people talking, having conversations. It was chanting.
Oh.
And that was one of those moments, too. It was like, oh, my gosh. And she said they both decided to head back to the truck, and they got in the truck, and they saw what looked like just a crowd of half-invisible soldiers walking in front of their truck. And they decided to just get out of there and drive away, which they did. She said she knew that he was freaked out because he actually drove them to a hotel and they slept in a hotel. Okay, so the next morning they got up and they're going to continue on their way. And he came in, she's getting ready in the hotel room, and he had gone out to the truck. And he came in and he said, "You've got to come out here and look at this." And she went out, and all over the truck, hundreds of handprints covered with a light sheen of dust. And she said they had washed the truck.
Oh,
and,
man.
This was, it creeped me out super bad. Yeah. So that was one of the good ones. There's so many. Okay, here's another one. This is called Skinwalker in Arizona.
Okay.
And the fellow who contributed it is named Lee Hanawu. I like to give people credit.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, let me everybody know, Annie Wilder is who we're talking to, and the book is called Trucker Ghost Stories. Trucker Ghost Stories, and it's her third book about ghost stories. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And I let everybody keep their own copyright. So if there's any TV show, because there are a lot of TV shows that come and they want to have people tell their story, and this way people can just go on and tell their story and you know.
Oh, that's good.
For them.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, okay. So Lee is half Navajo and half Hopi, and this story took place on the reservation where his grandma lived in Arizona. He said he was 14 years old at the time, and his little brother was like 9. And he said his little brother, who is now a soldier, told him that he, I mean, now it's 15 years after this happened, but he said had never saw anything that scared him as much as what they saw that night, what they experienced. Okay, so they are spending the summer with their grandma. They love being with their grandma, and he said that his grandma occasionally hired one of the local guys to do work around the house, and this fellow didn't have a driver's license or anything. So she let Lee, who was 14, take the pickup truck and drive the guy back to his place, which was like 4 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
So Lee and his younger brother and their dog got in the truck. The guy who did the repairs and the dog sat in the back of the truck, you know, the cab, or not the cab, the... Gosh, I'm spacing him, but the back of the truck.
Yeah.
And then he and his brother were in the truck. So they drove the guy
off. They were in the flatbed then.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
I should know that. Okay, so they dropped the guy off, and they're driving back, and he said it was, you know, a super dusty road, washboarding, all that. He said that the sun was setting, and the sky was really pretty, and he noticed at some point some movement in the shrubby, scrubby thing beside the road.
Mm-hmm.
And he assumed it was one of the sheep because there were free-roaming sheep on the reservation.
Right.
And when it didn't, like, dart out in front of the car, he stopped thinking about it. He just kept driving. And all of a sudden, his dog started barking. And he looked in the rearview mirror and just... felt terror because he saw this thing that was tall and skinny, covered with hair, kind of human but not human, running after their truck.
Oh, boy.
And his brother looked and he saw it too, and he said he started driving as fast as he could on the washboard road, and his brother was screaming and said, "It's catching up. And it's coming up your side." And he said he was so scared he could hardly breathe. And he thought they were going to die because this thing was basically on top of the truck. Like, they can keep up with the truck. And he had no idea what it was. It was, like, not any animal. There's no two-legged animal that runs on two legs after vehicles. And so then he saw another car coming the other way, which never happens on the res. Well, I'm sorry. At that part, I might be mixing up with another story. They did make it back to their grandma's house. They jumped out of the truck. They ran in, and he said they told their grandma what they'd seen, and she said that she didn't seem surprised, and she said it was a skinwalker, and that is, like, it's basically like bad magic, shape-shifting, and that there's evil magic in the world too, and that's what they had encountered. And he said, like, they were terrified that night. The windows, like, he said he didn't drive again on the reservation at night until he was 21. But he ended his story with, you know, just a little bit of speculating. Like, he said, you know, I know people might not believe this, or they might think it's a myth. He said, but I believe if there is good in the world and there's good power, there's also the opposite.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said, I, you know, talked about, like, the importance of just being respectful and not messing around with stuff. Not that they had messed around with stuff,
right.
But just acknowledging the existence of that.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty cool story.
Skinwalker is a creepy name for any kind of being.
I know.
So creepy.
Yeah.
Annie Wilder is the author of Trucker Ghost Stories. And Annie, before we get you out of here, you live in a haunted place and you have haunted tea parties. You host haunted tea parties in your home. Tell me about that.
Well, I lived in a haunted house for 25 years.
Okay.
We just moved in December, and I'm I'm very sad about leaving my house because I was planning to live there forever. I've written a little bit about it on my Facebook page, which you can get to through my website, AnnieWilder.com. We moved to, I hope to again offer at least, I call them spirited events. And that's, I had haunted tea parties for years because after my book came out, so many people wanted to see the house that I decided I would come up with something. And I thought a tea party was old fashioned. It was an old Victorian house.
Yeah.
Awesome house.
Right.
So we are now, we did leave our house. We are in a town a little further down the river, 20 miles away. And we have another Victorian house that is fabulous. Everyone has asked me if it's haunted. We do feel that there is some definite house energy here.
Yeah.
And I have been so kind of with the move and just a lot of things going on, I feel like I haven't been as tuned in, but I did come down the other night and sleep on the couch because I actually was so wide awake I needed to come down and read, not have a light on upstairs.
Right.
And as I was down here, the house made so many weird noises that I was thinking, like, okay, yes, this place is haunted.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a dream where two young girls in clothes from like maybe the 1940s or 50s were standing over looking at me, and I woke up and one of them said, oh, she can finally see us.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know, we'll see what happens.
Well, that sounds like that sounds like a promising start, Annie, I gotta tell you. So
I do like living in a haunted house with friendly ghosts.
Yeah. Okay, there you go. Annie Wilder is the author of some popular true ghost story books. Trucker Ghost Stories is the latest. And your website, as you said, is AnnieWilder.com.
Yep.
AnnieWilder.com. You can go through, go check that out and look up all her books and some of the stories. And you can link up to her Facebook page as well. Annie, it was so much fun talking to you and telling some really great, creepy, and fun stories.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Good.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely.
Too.
All right. Annie Wilder, Trucker Ghost Stories is her latest book. Check out AnnieWilder.com. All right. That was some creepy stuff. Picking up that hitchhiker when she's got hooves and, like, goat legs. I don't need that in my life. All right. So Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720. WGN. We'll get to the newsroom in a couple of minutes. WGN. This is the Nick DiGilio Show. Nick DiGilio is out sick. I am his producer, Tom Hush, filling in here by playing back some of Nick's interviews from the last couple of weeks, getting you all cut up so that when he comes back, you'll be all ready for the new stuff. Bunch of new shows once he comes back. If you want to send him a little message, let him know you're thinking about him. NickDShow@gmail.com. That's NickDShow@gmail.com is how you can send us a little email. Send them your well wishes. Same place that you send all your submissions for Straight Out of Context, Nick's D Show Spies, You Big Dummy, all that kind of stuff. We've been playing back some of the interviews from the last couple of weeks, catching you all up. This next one is Dan Feinberger, a good friend from The Hollywood Reporter.
comes around every couple of weeks. Talk a Little TV with Nick. If you missed him this past Wednesday night, Thursday morning, it was a real good one to have Dan Feinberg on for. A lot of great shows that they talked about, and you always want to be up to date with your TV. So, again, this is Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter talking with Nick. This is coming to us from this past Wednesday, catching us up with all of Dan's reviews here on 720 WGN.
Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter. Dan, how are you, sir?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing, Nick?
Not bad. Good to have you back. Dan Feinberg writes for The Hollywood Reporter. He's a TV critic. You can follow him at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. And we talk TV every couple of weeks. So let's jump right into some of the reviews that you've done.
So many things to jump in on.
Yeah. Yes. There is. Let's talk about this show Hunters, which is on Amazon, and I guess it's a big deal because it's Al Pacino doing television.
It is indeed. It is premiering Friday on Amazon. It is Al Pacino's first regular TV role, which doesn't mean that he hasn't been doing TV. He, of course, won an Emmy for Angels in America and has done a bunch of HBO movies.
Yeah, biopics. Yes. Yeah.
he played Phil Spector. He played Joe Paterno. So he's been very busy on TV, just hasn't done a regular TV role. And I think this one has gotten people's attention, in large part because of the Al Pacino of it, but also because the trailers have focused heavily on Al Pacino speaking with a very thick German accent and speaking little bits of Yiddish, and that intrigues people, as does the basic premise. And the premise is it's 1977, and there are Nazis among us in the United States, and a young man played by Logan Lerman, who people will know from lots of things, really. His grandmother dies, his grandmother, who was a Holocaust survivor, and this prompts him to discover that his grandmother's friend from back in the day, and by back in the day, I mean Auschwitz, is working with a group of Nazi hunters trying to find the identities of Nazis in the United States. So it has sort of these hints of kind of certain 70s, vaguely accurate or not accurate, but based on accurate paranoia, your boys from Brazil, your marathon mans, but also genuine fact-based Nazi hunting dramas like the Simon Wiesenthal story, for which Ben Kingsley was nominated for a bunch of awards, which I certainly watched in Sunday school. That's not what this is. This is wacky and wild. In my review, I called it juiceploitation, and I think that's what it is. And I think a lot of people are going to be surprised by what it is, and I was surprised that after 5 episodes, I can't tell you if I think it's good or not. but I think it's really interesting, and I think it's interesting to talk about. But if you ask me if this is a good show, I don't know. And that's a weird feeling for me to have as a TV critic.
I guess. Dan, I want to talk a little bit more about it, but we got to take a break here for a second, okay?
Sure.
All right, Dan Feinberg is with us, a Hollywood reporter. He talks TV and writes about it, and we talk TV every couple of weeks. Check out The Fine Print at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N.
Take a lot of love. We won't.
DiGilio show continues here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. We also every morning at after 2:30 we play some stand-up comedy from the Tonight Show and the Johnny Carson Show that you can watch actually on Antenna TV every night, and it's the best. We're going to feature the legendary George Carlin and one of his appearances on the Tonight Show for our stand-up segment this morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Dan Feinberg, we were talking about hunters, which you said you don't know whether it's good or bad.
And it continues to be a strange feeling, and I haven't gotten the answer during the commercial break. So, yeah, it's just an unnerving show because it is often really fresh, really stylish, really fun, and then you kind of have to sit back and go, wait, some of these things that are fun, I probably shouldn't be having fun with. What do I want to do with the fact that it's interspersing these blaxploitation, Jewsploitation, martial arts tropes in one scene and then cutting to flashbacks in concentration camps in World War II? How am I supposed to feel about that? It's a very complicated show for me to watch from my Jewish perspective,
right,
from my TV critic's perspective. But I've seen five episodes, and I'm definitely going to watch the next five, if only to sit there scratching my head.
By the way, it's called Hunters, and it is a show that's debuting on Friday on Amazon. And the big draw here is that it's Al Pacino in episodic television. But I'm looking at the other cast members. It's got a great cast. I mean, there's a lot of really terrific actors in this.
It really does. So Al Pacino, Logan Lerman, who at various different points has been on the brink of being a young star.
Yes.
And then you also have people including Carol Kane, who's always great, Saul Rubinek, who's always great, Josh Radner, Dylan Baker in a very, very, very showy turn as one of the potentially infiltrating Nazis, Lena Olin in a key role. If you keep watching multiple episodes, there are a lot of really great character actor cameos. John Noble from Fringe and various different things pops up in an episode. It's a great cast. It has a good, stylish look. It's got a lot of fun 70s things happening. The creator, David Weil, is obviously a big fan of comic books, and so there's a lot of the rooting out of the Jewish beginnings of a lot of these comic book legends and trying to figure out what they say about vigilante justice, what they say about vengeance, what they say about mercy, and how that perspective has been shifted from Talmudic Judaism into Marvel and DC. There's a lot going on here, and the question just becomes, is it a better show to sit and have a long discussion about than it is to watch? And I don't know the answer.
That's fascinating. It sounds very weird, too. But also, we haven't mentioned that it's executive produced by Jordan Peele, and they're really pushing his name on this. And all the advertisements and all the commercials and things that I've seen or read about, it all leads with executive produced by Jordan Peele.
Which is a choice. I mean, David Weil, who is the creator and who has never created a show before, is a tough person to sell the show on because he just doesn't have a resume that says, okay, here's who it's from. And he had written a number of different feature scripts that had been on the blacklist, the list of unproduced great Hollywood screenplays.
Yeah.
And he basically, I believe, ended up at the same agency or with the same agent as Jordan Peele. Jordan Peele said, let's get coffee, we'll talk. And at a certain point, David Weil pitched him the script. And Jordan Peele, who likes doing these sort of provocative genre exercises that also point to contemporary society and race, he seems like a logical fit. But that being said, anyone watching it because of Jordan Peele's name really should know that Jordan Peele did not write or direct any of this series and does not appear in it. So keep the perspective there.
Yeah, exactly. But it's good to have a name like that associated with it. I mean, it's not like did they really need Jordan Peele's name on this? You know, when you got something like, you got somebody like Al Pacino as your lead?
I think it helps to be able to say who it's from creatively, and I think that Jordan Peele does give some indication of tone to some viewers. I just don't know necessarily that they're the audience that's going to be sold on this as a show in general. I think this is a show that some people are going to love. I think it's a show that probably more people are going to come away feeling uncomfortable with in ways they can't define, and they'll just say, I dislike it, when what they mean to say is, this show makes me uncomfortable,
right,
which is a valid response, but it's tough.
It sounds fascinating to me. It really does. So I'm actually very curious and looking forward to it. So that debuts Friday on Amazon. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 4 o'clock. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. You can follow him at The Fine Print, FIEN, and get all his reviews there. Did we talk about the Oscars the last time you were on?
No, I believe that we missed what would have been the logical post-Oscars visit because of hockey or something to that effect. I know how you Chicagoans love your hockey, so I think that kept us from talking about
Yeah, we love our hockey, but we don't currently love our team. They're not playing very... They lost tonight 6-3, so it wasn't very fun. But anyway, I'd love to talk to you about the actual telecast. And you did write a full review of the 92nd Academy Award telecast, and overall, let's talk about what you thought of the telecast and some of the specifics and some of the things that you wrote about in your review.
I think I am now at this point going to start strongly advocating for people to stop pretending that these award shows should be hostless. I think that is my big takeaway from the Emmys and the Oscars this year, that we got lucky when the Oscars went hostless last year. Everyone was like, ooh, no one needs it. No, you do. Like, in a perfect year, you don't need a host. In a year that requires a little bit of finessing, it's what a host is supposed to be there for. I thought this Oscars telecast was so totally rudderless and directionless, and it got lucky that there was this great narrative because of this unprecedented thing that Parasite did. And that was great, and it was exciting, and it was fresh, and it made it feel like no Oscar telecast you'd ever seen before, because the person who did the most speaking, other than the director of the Best Picture, was the director's translator, which heaven knows is unprecedented.
But
I thought that the telecast itself was a mess. It was a lot of strange, underexplained ideas, things that just didn't get noted at all. Like, all they had to do was have someone come out on the stage and say, 17 years ago, we gave an Oscar to Eminem for Lose Yourself. He didn't show up that year to accept the award or to perform. Here he is now.
Right.
All you had to do was do that, and people would have gone, oh, okay, I guess I kind of understand. Why not? You know, but they kept doing that throughout the entire night, bringing people out for no reason. There were several musical performances that weren't introduced at all.
Right.
And just what was even happening? And then there were people who were being introduced so that they could then introduce presenters to introduce categories.
Right.
It was a very badly arranged show, I thought. What did you think?
I thought it was... I didn't think it was very good. And of course, it ran 3 hours and like 36 minutes long. And it was interminable at times. And I agree with you 100% about the weirdness of some of the choices that they went with. Especially people came out to introduce people who were going to introduce something. I mean, that to me is like, why are we doing this? I don't understand this. You know, and it wasn't that Eminem wasn't bad, because it was a great performance. But I too was scratching my head a little bit, going, "Why is Eminem performing this now?" So,
and they needed to say why they were doing certain things. It's not like people would have been like, "Oh, okay, well, if you know, so if that's the explanation, don't bother having Eminem show up." No, people would have been like, "Sure, great, have Eminem there. Why the heck not?"
Yeah,
no one was going to say, "Go away, Eminem." Well, some people probably would have, but that's neither there nor here. But they just kept doing that over and over again, and they kept kind of acknowledging that things made no sense. Like, they had the guy from 1917 up in the rafters saying how stupid it was that he was introducing someone to introduce something in a show that was already running too long, in the same way that you had Chris Rock and Steve Martin there acknowledging that they weren't really the hosts of the show, doing a monologue like they were totally the host of the show, and then saying, "Good thing we didn't host the show." What were you doing?
Yeah, yeah. And I was surprised by the results. I was pleasantly surprised by all the acting results were, you know, that was predicted. We knew that going in, who was going to win supporting actress and actor, and who was going to win actor and actress. That was a given. And and some of those speeches were pretty great. But I really was genuinely shocked when Parasite won Best Picture. I thought 1917 was going to steamroll through. And I knew something was up when Sam Mendes didn't get Best Director. I went, whoa, wait a minute. Something's going on here. So some of the results were fun, but the show itself was too long and it was a mess.
And I would say that this year's acting awards were the most predetermined they've ever been.
No question.
I think everyone says this every year, and it continues to be true, that the award season is too long. And so you get to the Oscars, and I would say most years when it comes to the acting awards, three of them are locked in 100%,
yes.
But there's one that's maybe a little bit questionable. And maybe with screenplay, there's a little bit of question on one. You know, there's a lot of that. But this year, those four winners, anyone who did an Oscar pool who didn't bet all four of the acting winners,
yeah,
just paid zero attention. And that's but a little dull.
Okay. Dan Feinberg, we continue our conversation on 720 WGN, writer for The Hollywood Reporter, TV critic. And you can follow him on Twitter and Facebook at The Fine Print, FIEN. Gileo Show continues right here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline Studio, Wednesday night into Thursday morning. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Dan Feinberg, TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, joins us. I am so glad that Brooklyn Nine-Nine is back. It's just consistently hilarious. And you do it. Tell everybody about TV's Top 5 podcast you do.
Yes, the TV's Top 5 podcast is a weekly podcast that I do with my THR colleague, Leslie Goldberg, who is THR's fantastic television reporter. If there's any news in Hollywood and TV, it comes from Leslie. And it's basically structured as we go through the week's biggest news stories, and each episode culminates with my Critics Corner, which is me talking about TV, as I do, and then we do a weekly showrunner spotlight where we've talked to some really spectacular showrunners in recent weeks, including Dan Gore of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. This week's interview is with the aforementioned David Weil of Hunters, and it goes into a lot of the depth on the things that fascinate me about the show. So it's a good conversation in that respect. But yeah, we talked with Dan Gore on the podcast about the new season of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, about the fact that it's been renewed for another season. He wanted to emphasize that very clearly because he knows the fans of Brooklyn Nine-Nine get a little bit nervous,
which is what happens
when Fox cancels your show.
Right.
So
right.
These things happen. But he wanted to reassure everyone that they don't need to worry. There's one more season at least after this one, and they're not viewing that season as being the last season necessarily.
Yeah.
So cross your fingers. But yeah, no, it's such a good show, and it's just so good to have the good broadcast comedies still be around. And so the fact that Good Place is now gone is sad, and yeah, you know, pour one out for the Good Place.
Yeah,
but there is still Brooklyn Nine-Nine, there's still Superstore, which I think is a really, really good show, and that just got renewed for another season itself. So there's some successful, really good comedies on broadcast.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
People need to watch them.
Yeah, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I just laugh out loud every single episode. And I really love, you know, how they're handling Andre Brower's character now, as he... As he's been demoted, and I thought they handled it beautifully, you know, during last week's episode.
That's the kind of thing that the show has in the past kind of glossed over. One of those big turn everything upside down twists from a finale, and then give it one episode in the next season, and then get back to business.
Yeah.
I mean, most shows tend to do that because you don't want to overturn the premise of the show entirely, but the fact is that you can have Holt in a diminished professional capacity, and it really just allows you to let Andre Brower do more of what Andre Brower has been so brilliant at on that show. And it doesn't actually upend what's so funny about that character, because so much of what's funny about that character is the way you puncture his absurd dignity, and so they've just been having a lot of fun with that.
They did, and I got to tell you, I happen to be a ridiculously massive fan of Vanessa Bayer, and she came in and stole the episode. She was so funny.
Everyone knows that you are a Vanessa Bayer fan, so
yes.
Don't worry.
Yes.
No, she's... She is really good, and she requires, I think she requires specific usage, which is part of why she hasn't had her own sitcom vehicle that's been successful since she left SNL, I think, or part of it is that I just don't think you can just turn things over to Vanessa Bayer. But if you use her in the right capacity, and if you use her surrounded by the right equally talented people, I think she's extremely funny, and I like the character they gave her on the show very much.
It was very, very funny. And I know you hated the show, but is anybody watching Indebted? And also, what a great cast, but it's a terrible show. Is that what I'm to understand?
It is a very bad show. It is a show where you have to basically not care at all about what any of them are doing, and you just have to say, I love Adam Pally from Happy Endings. I love Abby Elliott from the very brief period she was on SNL when they barely gave her anything to do, but she did a really good Drew Barrymore impression. I love Steven Weber because he's Steven Weber, and Fran Drescher is a certain kind of national treasure. I don't know if she's necessarily she's not going to be everybody's national treasure, but what she does spectacularly well.
Yeah.
And it's all just stuffed into an entirely less than generic NBC sitcom, which couldn't really figure out what its premise is, what its voice is. I've seen a few episodes, and they're all kind of different from each other because I just don't think anyone knows who the characters are or what they're doing there or why they're funny. I can't imagine this is a show that's going to have a long run, and I don't think it should. I think everybody involved should have the opportunity to do better things.
What's the general premise of it? I mean, it's just, as you said, it's a generic family sitcom, but what's the general premise and who plays what?
The general premise is a young couple, and this is Abby Elliott and Adam Pally, announce in the opening scenes that they're excited that after their kids have gone through their vague youth, they're about finally ready to have their lives back. So they're celebrating that they finally have their front closets back and they have their lives under control. Now, the thing is, you discover very quickly that their kids are 4 and 6 or something.
What?
What parents do you know who celebrate getting their lives back when their kids are 4 and 6? It makes no sense. I think at some point, this must have been written as a parents whose kids finally graduate from high school, they become empty nesters, and then their parents move back in, which has been the premise of a half dozen sitcoms
sure.
the past 5 years.
Of course.
But then they got Adam Pally interested, and they said, okay, fine, we'll lower the ages of the characters, and it makes no sense. So anyway, they're celebrating they're getting their lives back, despite having two kids in elementary school or younger. And then at that point, his parents, played by Stephen Weber and Fran Drescher, announced that they are deep in debt and that they're moving back into the house for some reason. And the nature of their debt is introduced in the first episode relating to medical bills, which are never mentioned again. And the debt becomes something where it's just sort of like, okay, well, I guess maybe they need money, but it's not a serious thing. And maybe they're living at the home, but maybe they're not. It just, whatever the premise is, it just evaporates into space, and it becomes Fran Drescher being a Luddite and saying things about the tweeter and being vaguely racist, but her character's only vaguely racist in the first episode. She then just becomes kind of genially dumb in subsequent episodes. It's just so inconsistent, and it's one of those shows that I have to blame on development, where it's like a network executive had to make sure they knew what the show was before they made a pilot and before they ordered 13 episodes of it, as opposed to in the process.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. That sounds terrible.
the problem is there are also like five sitcoms this mid-season that have almost the same premise. There's Outmatched on Fox, which is, to my mind, slightly better than a couple of them. There's another one on ABC, United We Fall. CBS has Broke, which is coming out in a couple weeks. They're all basically the same comedy, and none of them are funny.
Wow. Well, that's not good. Okay. Dan Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter. He writes about TV, and we will continue to talk TV right here on 720 WGN.
Don't do it, darling. Don't you dare look in there. You said you didn't want to see me, but you've been looking for me everywhere. And you know that you're gonna find me if you keep on drinking fast. 'Cause honey, I'm right there waiting on you at the bottom of your glass. And here I
Giglio here on 720 WGN, continuing. We are live in the Skyline studio here. And the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And Dan Feinberg is with us from The Hollywood Reporter. Dan, what is Sacred Lies, The Singing Bones?
I only barely know is the answer on this one. It is one of the last originals that Facebook Watch currently still has. Basically, after Facebook Watch canceled Sorry for Your Loss, a show that I am still unhappy that they canceled, and after they quickly canceled Limetown, the Jessica Biel show that most people didn't know that ever existed, Sacred Lies, it comes from a number of fairly reputable producers and directors. The writer is a True Blood veteran. The director is Scott Winant, who's done a bunch of prestige TV shows, and it has a supernatural thing and a music thing, and I'm aware it exists, but I'm not at all aware of why this is the thing that Facebook Watch thinks it can go all in on. Just Facebook Watch, I was totally engaged and willing to go along with them when they were supporting a couple good shows, but once they showed that they weren't able to keep those good shows on air or to get any sort of buzz or awards attention when Sorry for Your Loss should have been an award contender. Elizabeth Olsen should have been in every award conversation there was for that show.
Yeah.
And she wasn't because they didn't know what to do with the show. So I'm taking a step back from Facebook Watch at this point. It's one of those, okay, prove to me that you're serious about this and I'll get serious with you guys again. I think that's my approach to Facebook Watch.
The only reason that I even know about it is because I'm on your website and and I looked, you know, I looked at it and I happened to be a really big fan of Juliette Lewis, so I was like, oh, what's that? So
they did a panel at the TCA press tour for it, and they tried talking around in circles how they were going to get people's attention, and they all talked intelligently about the show they were making. I just can't personally invest at this moment until Facebook Watch proves to me that it really wants to be serious about being in the original TV marketplace. Because if they aren't, and that's totally fine. Not everyone needs to make original TV programs.
Sure,
that is I've got other things to watch. but yeah, so that's where I am on,
okay,
on Thinker Lies.
Okay, there we go. All right. Very interested in this. Slow Burn, which is a docuseries about Watergate, correct?
Indeed. It is based on the very popular, very successful Slate podcast that has now done multiple seasons. The first season was Watergate. The second season was the Clinton impeachment. And the third season, which I think just ended, I'm only halfway through it, so I'm not sure where it actually is in real time, is the Tupac Biggie murders. And basically the kind of the gimmick to it is, you know, the big names in the story, here are the lesser names, or here are the smaller names, or here are the names that you might have known if you were there in the moment, but you might have forgotten. And so Slow Burn as a TV series, which is on Epix and premiered last weekend, is a lot like Slow Burn the podcast, only, and get this, there's a visual component.
Oh, wow.
One of those things where you start a sentence and you realize it's going into a really, really obvious place by the time you get to the end of it. And,
right.
And you're already in, so you might as well continue to the end. But yeah, if you've listened to the Slow Burn podcast, a lot of it will be familiar to you, and that's okay because, you know, not everyone did. And so, like, the first episode, for example, is Martha Mitchell, who was John Mitchell's wife and who was kind of famous at the time for being a beloved enough figure on the Washington scene that, for heaven's sake, she made a cameo on Laugh-In, and everyone knew who she was and laughed at her or with her. But at the beginning of Watergate, she was this truth teller who no one believed and who was treated like she was crazy. And even though she was trying to point out to anyone who would listen that there was this conspiracy, but people didn't want to listen. So the first episode is largely her story. Subsequent episodes focus on, for example, there's an interview with one of the Watergate burglars who I had not seen an interview with. That was intriguing. He was one of the Cuban nationals who was brought in as part of the dirty tricks that the committee to reelect the president was pulling. Subsequent episodes feature the only surviving member of the Senate Watergate hearings investigative team. It's really interesting, and just enough of it is new that if you are interested and if you can figure out where Epix is on your television, you could be really interested in it. I enjoyed watching it just like I enjoyed listening to the podcast, but I have sort of an odd personal memory when it comes to Watergate, which was just before I was born, so it's not a real memory, but like, I can watch All the President's Men over and over again, and there are always details that I forget, and I don't know why it is, because I've seen the movie enough times that I should know every line of dialogue by heart.
Yeah.
But there are always parts that surprise me.
And I think part of that has to do with it being an amazingly written movie and an amazingly directed movie, but also part of it has to do with the fact there are just a lot of crazy characters in in that story.
Yeah, yeah.
And so sometimes you just can't distinguish between Halderman, Ehrlichman, and five of the other ones, and so you just go along for the ride.
Right. You know, like you, I've seen All the President's Men more than I can even count. It's one of my favorite movies, and I still find it. As triumphantly suspenseful every time I watch it, and it's also really funny, and God, all the performances. Jason Robards is just unbelievable in that movie. But it's interesting because Watergate is the first big story that I remember as a kid, because the hearings were on every day, and so Watergate is the very first news story. The big news story that I recall as a child, and so I've always found Watergate to be a fascinating thing.
Well, and at least one of the episodes is focused heavily on how everybody was watching these hearings every day, and how certain of the people involved became public celebrities against all odds. It's good, and it's only and Slow Burn is only 6 episodes, only 6 hours, and it moves really well. Again, it requires you figuring out where Epix is
I watch Epix pretty regularly.
Oh, yes, because you are a large fan of Perpetual Grace Limited.
Yes,
so,
that's right. that's right.
They've done a lot of Get Shorty. They've done a fair number of very interesting shows. But as I consistently say, despite the fact that I get every single imaginable channel on my television, because I watch a lot of TV.
Yes, you do.
I don't get Epix. And I don't know why I don't get Epix, because I've told my cable provider a dozen times, just give me everything.
Yeah.
And for some reason, they keep not giving me Epix. It's odd.
I subscribed to it simply because Dana DiLorenzo was in Perpetual Grace, and she's my future ex-wife, so I subscribed to it, and now I watch it. I think there's some really good programming on it, and I'm waiting for the second season of Perpetual Grace to come back. So,
and they also have some fine movies as well.
They
so
do.
Yay, yeah. Epix, I suppose.
Epix is good. Okay, Dan Feinberg is here, and he writes about TV for Hollywood Reporter and joins us bi-weekly, and our conversation continues right here on 720 WGN.
I can wait another day until I call you. You've only got my heart on a string and everything a flutter. But another lonely night might take forever. We've only got each other to blame. It's all the same to me, love, 'cause I know what I feel.
WGN. It's Nick DiGilio's show. Nick DiGilio is out sick tonight. I'm his producer, Tom Hush, filling in here with some of his best interviews over the last couple weeks, getting you all caught up while he catches up on some sleep. Not feeling too well. If you want to send him a little note saying, feel better, Nick, all that good stuff, send an email over to nickdshow@gmail.com. Make sure he gets those. That's where he's going to see all those well wishes. And he should be back as soon as possible, but we got to get him rested up first. We're going to continue here with playing back some of those segments from the last couple weeks. As always, it's good to hear from our friend Dan Feinberg, TV critic at the Hollywood Reporter. He's been telling us all about the latest TV. It's got to be great to be caught up on all the TV. So you're going to want to listen to a couple more bits of this. And then coming up, we'll also hear from a really interesting conversation between Nick and the owner of Midwest Dispensary, talking about the business of medical marijuana and recreational marijuana and his own experience dealing with it. But for right now, we'll continue on this Best of Nick D show with our friend Dan Feinberg, again, Hollywood reporter, talking all things TV. Here until 4 a.m., it's the Nick DiGilio Show on 720 WGN.
312-981-7200 is the phone number as we continue here. Dan Feinberg, Hollywood reporter, joins us. Dan, tell us about Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet.
Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet is premiered last week or the week before, I guess, on Apple TV Plus, and it comes from many of the people behind It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. So that's, it was created by Rob McElhenney and Charlie Day, obviously, who have been there the whole time, and Megan Gans, who has been an executive producer and writer on Sunny for many, many, many years. And it's behind the scenes of a high fantasy online role-playing game that is rolling out its latest expansion, and it's about the power dynamics behind the scenes, including the game's creative director, played by Rob McElhenney, but also the engineers, the writers. The F. Murray Abraham plays a former, briefly successful science fiction fantasy author from the 70s who is now writing in between plot points for a video game that he's never played and is vaguely amusing in that context. And the cast includes a lot of very, very good people, as you can guess from that. Danny Pudi is in it. And it is a show that is increasingly funny and confident as it goes along. I thought that a lot of it at the beginning was a little on the generic side. Some of it felt like kind of second-rate It's Always Sunny episodes with video games attached sometimes. But by the end, I thought it was doing some interesting things. It was having some pretty solid recognition of the role of women in gaming and why that is a complicated thing in the politics. One of the main characters is played by Charlotte Nickdow, who's an Australian actress who I've never seen before, but she is very good and gets better as she goes along. And yeah, I was laughing by the end of this. I was not laughing at the beginning, but they're only half-hour episodes. The first season is only 9 episodes. It's already been renewed for a second season. So there's a lot of potential here, I think, even if it's not as good as Sunny out of the box.
Okay. Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet on Apple TV Plus. How long has Sunny been on? Do we even know at this point how long it's been on?
We lose track because the numbers are remarkable when you stop and think about other comparable shows, but also when you stop and think about what a little show it was when it started. So the show has been on for 14 seasons. Oh, it's been 154 episodes. And it's just so hard to remember that when the show started, it was this thing that the guys made on spec for no money at all, having never done it before, that FX put on at a time when FX had never really had a successful half-hour comedy series. And it is a show where its longevity is remarkable, but the only thing that might be more remarkable is that it's still an incredibly funny show when it's hitting on all cylinders. And it probably does most of each season. And when you talk to the guys about the show, they've had periods where they've mentioned, oh, maybe it's coming to the end or whatever, but I don't even think they say that anymore. Like the way it sounds when Rob talks about the show is, yeah, I think we'll come back and we'll keep making it. Then we'll keep doing other things that we want to do as well, but we like doing Sunny, so we're just going to keep coming back to it.
Yeah.
And so the idea that this could somehow be a show that runs 25 seasons, it sounds ridiculous, but I can imagine it.
Yeah, so can I. And that's and you're right. I mean, it's just as funny now as it was before. And they're still doing really funny and fresh stuff. But you know, obviously they're out doing other things, including what we were just talking about. But what was that awful Charlie Day show that took place in the funeral home, in the retirement home?
Tomato, tomato. That would be the Cool Kids, where there was no way of knowing. There was really very little way of watching that show and going, oh, sure, that's from Charlie Day. And Charlie Day has no on-camera appearance in this at all. And after Mythic Quest, rather. And after the first episode, I don't think he wrote any of the episodes, but you know, he does movies, he does all these things.
Sure.
Howard and there's going to be a third season of E.T. Bio at some point, whenever Peacock exists, the streaming service that it was renewed for its third season on.
Okay.
So they're all doing well, and we need more Caitlin Olsen on our team. I feel like that's probably the bottom line.
I totally agree. I couldn't agree more. I was so angry when I was so angry when they canceled the Mick. I really was so angry. So yeah, she needs more TV time. Dan Feinberg from the Hollywood Reporter, TV critic from the Hollywood Reporter, and we're chatting here, and it's going to continue on 720 WGN. DeGilio here on the Nick DeGilio Show, live in the Skyline Studio on a Thursday morning. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Dan Feinberg from the Hollywood Reporter is with us. Dan, a couple of weeks ago, a new A.D. Falco show premiered. I have not watched it, and it's called Tommy, but I really like her.
Yeah, I think you may want to just go back and watch The Sopranos again,
okay.
Or possibly Nurse Jackie. This is a show where the first episode I thought was pretty decent. The premise of the show is that she is a New York born and raised cop who is brought in after a serious number of scandals in the LAPD to become the first female and the first gay female head of the LAPD, and thus faces all manner of controversy, second guessing, underestimating, etc. And the first episode, which was written by Paul Attanasio, who some people will know as the creator of House, as the creator of Homicide: Life on the Streets, etc. The first episode, I thought, was an above-average piece of broadcast character introduction. You know, not mind-blowing, but it did a good job of bringing in a lot of characters, a lot of actors who I really like, including Thomas Sadowski from Newsroom, Adelaide Clemens, who I loved on Rectify back in the day, a lot of really good actors, and I thought it did a good job with that. Well, Paul Attanasio's gimmick is that he writes pilots and then leads shows. He's not a guy who wants to be running a show for 15 years. He likes to introduce things and hand it off. And the second episode I thought was really bad, and the third episode I just thought was completely generic. The third episode is a Hollywood hashtag Me Too with a studio executive, that plot line, and it wasn't awful. It was just pretty generic. So by the time I got to the third episode, I was out of whatever glow I thought I was getting off of the first episode, and seeing some of the comments on Twitter and on my Facebook page from conservative people responding to the show, I kind of want to keep watching it for the purposes of supporting it on that line, because apparently some people are very outraged that there would be a TV show with the main female character who's gay and says a couple times that she's gay. That's all that she does. It's not like she's having graphic sex with women in the show, but apparently even saying it is offensive to some people. And so, yeah, but that's not going to be enough to get me to keep watching a mediocre CBS procedural, yeah. Unfortunately.
That's too bad, because I'm a big fan of Edie Falco, and
No, she's fantastic, and it's too bad the last thing that she had was the not very good Menendez Brothers thing where she had that ridiculous curly blonde wig on NBC. That was really not good for anybody. But no, you know, she's a titan. She's an icon. She's fantastic, and she's really good here too. She would be as good as the show would let her be. The show is just not letting her be anywhere near as good as we all know that she can and should be.
Okay, that's too bad. Okay, tell us about Lock and Key.
Lock and Key is on Netflix and premiered a couple weeks ago, and it's another one where Leslie Goldberg and I did a good showrunner interview on TV's Top 5, the THR podcast. Mm-hmm. And the showrunners in this case are Lost veteran Carlton Cuse and Haunting of Hill House veteran Meredith Averill. And it's based on a graphic novel by Stephen King's son, Joe Hill, that has been a multi-decade now process to bring it to the screen. It was developed as a feature first. It didn't go forward. Then it was developed as a Fox pilot that, again, didn't go forward. Then this version was developed first at Hulu. Hulu didn't go forward with it, but Netflix picked it up. It's a long journey. And the show itself, as you watch it, it's hard to describe. It's hard to describe what it's about, what its tone is. And you can kind of get a feeling that that's part of the reason why it's taken as long as it has to get to the screen. The story involves a family moving into an ancestral house in Massachusetts, and the house has, well, magical keys hidden throughout it that do magical things. Some open doors to other dimensions, some bring the dead back to life, some allow you to go inside people's heads, and see what's going on in their thoughts and their memories and stuff. And there are a lot of really good ideas here, and you can see why it's been so popular as a comic series. I would say that of the Netflix season's 10 episodes, I thought 5 of them were good and 5 of them were a mess. And that's just ends up being a mixed review at that point. It's a little bit spooky. It's a little bit fantastical, but it's not quite sure what its target audience is supposed to be or the kind of show it wants to be. So it ends up being a little bit Stranger Things-y, but not as coherent and cohesive as Stranger Things. There were elements that I enjoyed throughout. I just wish I had enjoyed it more as a whole.
Okay. It sounds intriguing. I'm not familiar. Looking at the cast list, I don't think I'm familiar with anybody.
I think you would discover that you recognize some of them. Who's in it? Darby Stanfield is the mother of the three kids, and she was a regular on Scandal, so that's where she's from. One of the kids is Connor Jessup, who was fantastic for several seasons on American Crime on ABC, mm-hmm. Back when that was a show that existed. But it's a lot of relative newcomers because it's a young cast. And yeah. So some of them are interesting, and I can see wanting to see more of them. The main performance is by a young kid who is sort of precocious in that child actor kind of way, and some people seem to be a bit annoyed by him, and that's just how it goes when you have precocious kids on TV shows.
Yeah, that's true.
There are some good special effects. It's not very scary. Like, it feels early on like it might be a kind of horror series, but it's not Haunting of Hill House, despite having some similar producers. It's not bad. It's just, it requires you be on its wavelength, and I'm not sure what its wavelength is really trying to be.
Okay. All right. And as Netflix does, the whole series is available to watch, right?
Indeed. That is, it is all up there and has not yet been renewed for a second season, I don't believe, but it sets itself up to go forward, even though the first season covers most of the 6 volumes of the graphic novel.
Okay. Wow. All right. What can we look forward to, Dan?
Well, what you can look forward to, and the primary thing people can look forward to, is the start of the new season of Better Call Saul. That is the thing that's coming back that is excellent and just tremendous to have back. There are a lot of good things on TV at this moment, but a lot of the best things are the things that are coming back. So you got Better Call Saul coming back this weekend, and I've seen the first 3 episodes of the new season, and they're fantastic. And then we're only a couple of weeks from the return of Better Things. I believe that's mid-March.
Oh, and God, so I can't wait.
As regular listeners know, we will be discussing that one on a bi-weekly basis. So there's a lot of good stuff that's sort of coming on the horizon, and a lot of the best stuff is coming. So if you feel like you've hit a slow patch in your spring TV, don't worry, it's about to pick up again.
Okay, and briefly, how is the new season of Homeland?
The new season of Homeland is heading towards an end. That's really how it feels. It feels as if they're going in a direction that is going to reach the conclusion. And since the show has already been announced as ending after this season, it will be interesting to see where they feel like they want to leave a show that was at one point extremely significant and now kind of gets a lot of that show's still on reactions from people. So I'll honestly be looking forward to seeing how it ends, just out of pure curiosity, having been on that whole journey with them.
Yeah, I kind of stopped. I think a lot of didn't a lot of people stop watching it?
A lot of people stopped watching it, and a lot of people stopped watching at different points. And the thing is, if you were curious to see how it ended, you really could just jump back in at the start of this season, because so much stuff has happened and it really has become such a blur that I don't remember a lot of the specific details from like at least 3 seasons. And, you know, I would never tell anyone, oh, you need to watch those 3 seasons to catch up. If you felt like you wanted to see how the show ended, you could totally tune in, watch this last run, and I think you'd be able to catch up if you cared. And if you don't, those first couple seasons were really great, and that can be your memory of Homeland, too.
Okay. All right. Okay. Dan Feinberg, Hollywood reporter. You can check him out at The Fine Print, F-I-E-N. Always a pleasure, Dan, and we will talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good, Nick. Talk
okay.
to you later.
Take care. There you go. Dan Feinberg here on 720 WGN.
It's great to be back home. Home is where I want to be. I've been on the road so long, my friend. And if you came along, I know you couldn't disagree. It's the same old story.
Sheriff said to me. 720 WGN, it's the Nick DiGilio Show. Nick is out sick this morning. I'm his producer, Tom Hush. Just giving a quick fill-in here for him while he rests up at home. We're playing some of the interviews from the last couple of weeks as we get y'all caught up so that when Nick comes back, it's going to be all new, all fresh here on the Nick DiGilio Show. Coming up here, I think one of our favorites from the last couple of weeks, Neil McQueenie from Midway Dispensary, which is over on the south side by Midway Airport. They are a dispensary operating out there doing medical and recreational marijuana. And he and Nick had a very interesting conversation about the future of the business, how Neil got into it, all that good stuff. 312-981-7200 if you want to shoot us a text, pass along to Nick, or if you want to send him any of your well wishes, nickdshow@gmail.com, where you send all your typical Friday features submissions. So we'll keep it going here, playing the best of the past 2 weeks of Nick, his interviews, because he is sick this morning. He'll be back as soon as possible. We'll just keep him in our thoughts and keep everything going for him. But for now, here is Neil McQueeny from Midway Dispensary.
Neil McQueeny is the owner of Midway Dispensary on South Archer Avenue in Chicago. As you all know, and on January 1st, recreational cannabis became legal, the sale of legal cannabis. And to say it was popular is an understatement. Neil McQueeny is the owner of Midway Dispensary. Neil, did you think that it was going to go as well as it did?
I was cautiously optimistic, Nick.
Yeah. Well,
we put a ton of time into it, like everybody else, and it was the everybody out there was it was amazing time to be out there on January 1st, and it all going so well. It was great.
The numbers are just nuts. I mean, for the month of January, over $39 million was spent on legal cannabis.
That's pretty staggering.
Yeah, it really is. Tell me
about, especially considering all the shortages that we had. And the people we had to turn away because we, you know, couldn't stay open 24 hours.
How did you get started in the business? And tell me a little bit about Midway Dispensary.
Sure. Hey, thanks. I'm a trial attorney by trade, and after 2008, a lot of the clients went belly up. So we were looking for new ways to generate revenue, and I started in the gaming industry, video gaming terminals. When that went legal under Governor Quinn, he passed the Medical Cannabis Program Act, and it was pretty simple to go from one highly regulated industry to another. I was going to get a bunch of clients and ended up just going for a license myself with a great team of partners, including my brother, and we ended up getting one of the licenses, which was pretty exciting. And then we had to figure out what to do with it.
How long has Midway Dispensary been around?
We opened our doors on April 26, 2016.
And
just in time to miss the 420 holiday.
Well, you know what's funny is that this entire April is going to be a 420.
Oh, this entire year is going to be a 420.
Well, yeah. yes, I would think so. So have they slowed down at all, and how are you guys coping with the demand?
The demand's been incredible. We're limited by the amount of product that they produced. We're not a vertically integrated dispensary, so we're an independent mom and shop store, so we have to get all of our product from licensed Illinois cultivators. And they haven't built out all of their facilities, so they're not at 100%. So there's a flower shortage, and there's some other products that we can't quite get that we're used to getting when it was just a medical program with 55 dispensaries in the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been, we ramped up our staffing, we extended our hours, we've educated the purchasers, we've educated our patients, we told them all to stock up in December to get as much as they can so that they could withstand the shortage. And so far it's been pretty good. We only sell adult use on weekends from Friday to Sunday.
Oh, okay.
And the rest of the time is for our medical patients.
Oh, I see. Okay. We're talking with Neil McQueeny, who is the owner of Midway Dispensary on Archer in Chicago, about medical marijuana and legal recreational marijuana and how incredible the business has been. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. So what about that first week? How crazy was it? Were you nervous?
I was terrified. We did a ton of work to get ready for it. Working with the state regulators, working with the city of Chicago, working with the Chicago Police Department, who, by the way, was and is just amazing, helping us and making sure that nobody's getting any silly ideas and watching the lines and everything like that. But all the work we went into it, we had to reapply for our adult use license, so we had to submit all of our application again into the state to get that adult use license, and then it was working with the cultivators to make sure that we had enough product for the adult use purchasers when they came in. I mean, we're by the airport, so we expected a large contingent of out-of-towners to come in and check us out. So we're preparing for that for, 2 months. And still prioritizing our medical patients the whole time.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a dance you got to do. But for us, that's what we're there for. We're there for the patients. Everything else with the purchasers, the adult use, it's gravy. And we, you know, we treat them all the same. It's all about service and customer care and education and explaining to them the product. You know, it's not like going into a, it's not like going into a bar and ordering any one of the beers. You know, there's specific strains and cannabis profiles that people are curious about and want to know about. And, you know, what I tell people is it's all medicine, regardless of the tax rate they're charging you. You know, everybody has an endocannabinoid system. The medicine affects you, and how does it affect you? And we want you to know how it affects you before you use it.
Mm. Now, how many medical patients do you service usually?
Well, we started off with 6 patients, and we're at about 1,300, 1,400 today.
Oh, man. Wow.
Yeah, it was a little scary in the beginning.
Yeah. I bet. yeah. So is there a preferred method upon which to consume cannabis? Because there are a lot of different ways that people do it. What's the most popular at the dispensary?
I guess flower would be, you know, just smoking a rolling a joint or smoking a bong seems to be everybody has seen it at least, if not tried it themselves. So flower is still number one in the state of Illinois. I used to like it a lot, but I'm more of an edibles guy.
Okay.
Now. So, and I see a lot of transitioning from that flower to the edibles. You know, a lot of doctors, a lot of people don't like to have you smoke your medicine.
Sure.
So there's a ton of other ingestion forms. The science is finally caught up to the medicine, and it comes in all varieties. Mm. You know, everything you see at a Walgreens, you can see at the store with the ingestion methods.
No, it's really pretty crazy. Neil McQueenie is the owner of Midway Dispensary. Did you, you know, as you know, someone, I'm in my 50s, so and I suspected at some point.
You don't sound a day over 40.
Well, thank you, I appreciate that. And I remember, you know, wondering if they would ever legalize pot. It had been a talk for a long time, and back in the 70s, you know, you were buying pot from some dude on the corner and getting yourself a nickel bag, as they used to call it, and all that stuff. Did you ever think you'd see the day when it would not only be, you know, legal, but also would be so incredibly popular?
Oh, God, no. It was at 95 when legal in California with the medical program.
Yeah.
And still, I never thought it would be, I'd never lived to see Illinois go legal medically, let alone recreationally. It's been fast and furious, and Illinois has done, you know, say what you want about the government, but they have done a fantastic job with this program, with this rollout.
Mm-hmm.
From the medical patients to the recent adult use rollout. It's just been every state has hiccups when they do this, and Illinois really did a great job of minimizing the hiccups, and we're still working with them every day to make sure we write those as
well. Yeah, well,
this is something, you know, exciting and unexpected, and it's historic. It's wonderful to be a part of.
Yeah. I really never thought I'd see the day. I really did. Neil McQueenie is the owner of Midway Dispensary. We continue our conversation here on 720 WGN. Neil McQueenie is the owner of Midway Dispensary on Archer Avenue in Chicago, and we are talking about the rollout, the incredibly successful rollout of recreational cannabis when it became legal on January 1st, and it just went over like gangbusters. Neil, how dealing with the state has been a great thing then on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's been working with our regulators to make sure that the rollout was successful. It has been a great thing. I don't know if it's, I'm not going to say it's been great the whole time since the beginning. Just working with the state to make sure that everything is, all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed, to make sure that the patients and other purchasers are able to get their medicine has been, it's been a good experience.
Now, what the whole dealing with the shortages, how have you you at Midway been dealing with it and other dispensaries? I know that a lot of dispensaries, many dispensaries ran out. I mean, the product was just sold out.
And we sold out. We were purchasing more and more. I think it was after December 1st we could start purchasing product for adult use. So we just bought as much as we could possibly fit in our vault and getting ready for January 1st. And I think we were one of the last ones to run out. I think we lasted till January 4th before we actually ran out. But yeah, people were, we ran out of flower, I think, day two.
Oh, man.
Excuse me. And it's very similar around the state. I mean, we all talk to each other, make sure, you know, what's going on, seeing if there's any variances or variables going on in other areas of the state. But it was all pretty consistent that huge lines, huge demand, and people ran out of flower very quickly.
Did you see that the Girl Scouts were setting up tables with selling cookies at the dispensaries?
It's great. My daughters, we always gave out Girl Scout cookies because my kids were in Daisies and Girl Scouts a couple years ago, and we got a few troops coming over this weekend, so we're excited for that too.
I just think that's very smart business on their parts. Sitting out,
we're training the next generation of fantastic businesswomen for the state of Illinois.
It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're talking with Neil McQueenie, owner of Midway Dispensary on South Archer in Chicago. What are your hours?
We are currently open Monday to Saturday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
But only on the weekends you sell. It's all medical, as you said, Monday through Friday, correct?
Yeah, we're medical 7 days a week. We only sell adult use currently with the current limitations on product availability from Friday to Sunday. Same hours. And medical patients, if there's a line, they hop the line, come right to the front, get first access.
Okay. Now, what about for people who don't usually partake or have not partaken in the use of marijuana? What are sort of the sort of general benefits and what to expect by the full legalization?
For individuals or?
Well, start with individuals, yeah.
Sure. And we had a bunch of those people who were in line on January 1st trying to see what all the fuss was about.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them, you know, they just wanted a joint, you know, one single product, a joint or a chocolate, something to just experiment, kind of bucket list type deal. And, you know, those are the patients that are the purchasers that we really want to talk to and say, it's a great idea, but make sure that you understand what you're getting into, you know. Don't just go for the highest THC potent thing. There's real medical benefits to it, which you can use, you know, with a little bit or a lot. So for some people who didn't want to come in and get the patient card, they wanted to wait for it to get adult use, but they still had, you know, these conditions that they wanted help with. So anything with some CBD in there, cannabidiol, that everyone's been talking about that you can get all over the place.
Yeah.
In addition to, you know, some of the THC, like a 1-to-1 ratio or 2-to-1 ratio type product, is great for what they're looking for, either pain relief or anti-anxiety or, you know, anti-nausea, depending on what their condition is. So, you know, we've been spending a lot of time learning about that medicine and sharing the information, educating our patients with it. And it's the same thing with educating purchasers. You know, for whatever reason, they don't want to get a card or they just don't use it that much where it's, you know, they want to get a lot of product or visit the store that often. So they come in for, you know, once a month for one type of product that works for their condition. Or sometimes, you know, they just need to get a stiff drink cocktail like product and, you know, just have a good time on a Friday night,
which is
what we're getting into a bit more now.
Yeah, well, clearly there were lines around the block for that specific reason. What are some of the conditions that can be treated with THC and CBD?
Well, the state has approved, I think it's 43 conditions, and you know, cancer is probably the most prevalent one. Currently, as a cancer patient, what works for me is high CBD for anti-pain and anti-nausea and recovery after a treatment of chemotherapy. And that THC, it's kind of, if you just use the CBD alone, It's a great product, but it's kind of like fighting with one hand tied behind your back without that THC. That THC and that CBD really work together in your endocannabinoid system to give you full body relief and help heal a lot of the damage that's been done with other treatments like the chemo or opioids. Last year they passed the opioid bill where you can get, if you have opioids, you can elect to take that prescription and get medical cannabis to use for pain control. So you're not using that addictive product.
Mm.
So it's been, and that's been very successful as well for the patients that we've had.
We're talking with Neil McQueenie, who's the owner of the Midway Dispensary at 5648 South Archer in Chicago, about the incredible success of starting on January 1st the legalization of recreational marijuana. You know, let's talk a little bit about the quality of marijuana nowadays as opposed to back in the 60s and 70s. I mean, you remember the days when there was actually seeds in marijuana?
Well, you need the seeds.
Yeah.
You just don't want to pay for it.
Right. Right. So what's the difference? Like, is the product more potent now than it was back in those days?
See, people say that, and I'm not sure what they're exactly talking about. There's a lot of different changes in the extractions. So there's more potent medicine out there because they've taken the THC extracted from the flower into these concentrates. So there's the waxes and the shatters, which are far higher THC than just rolling up a joint.
Yeah.
I don't know if, you know, you can breed higher potency THC, but I would say it's not that dissimilar from what people were experiencing earlier. It's just more prevalent, and it depends on the product that you're using. So if you're going to go, if you use the joint in the 70s, you use the joint now, you're going to get the similar effects.
Yeah.
But if you're going to, you know, go from smoking a joint in the 70s to taking a gram, you know, doing a dab on a dab rig, it's going to be a lot more potent. You're going to have a different experience, and you're going to think it's a lot more potent than it was.
Yeah. Yeah. So it just depends on that. So what are the restrictions of use on marijuana? There are still restrictions despite the fact that it's legal, correct?
Yeah. Thank God. There are still restrictions.
Yeah.
You got to be 21 and over for adult use, or if you have a medical card, you have to be registered with the state of Illinois as a medical patient for the program.
Mm-hmm.
So no public use. You can't use it anywhere in public. You got to use it in private property. You know, you can't drive around with it. They still have somewhere operating under the influence laws that you got to be aware of. The allotments are different. So if you have a medical card, you can get up to 2.5 ounces of medical cannabis every 14 days. And for Illinois residents over 21 in the recreational market, it's 30 grams of flower, 5 grams of concentrates, and I think it's 500 milligrams of cartridges.
Mm.
And out-of-state residents, it's half that. So there's still a lot of restrictions, restrictions on availability, allotments, and where you can and who can use it.
All right. Neil McQueenie is the owner of Midway Dispensary, and we're talking here on the Nick DiGilio Show about now the legalization of recreational marijuana and the incredible success throughout the month of January. And if you didn't hear, Illinois dispensaries sold nearly $40 million worth of cannabis in 1 month. So to say that this is a success is an understatement. Neil McQueenie will continue the conversation here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio on a Wednesday morning. 312-981-7200. Neil McQueenie is the owner of Midway Dispensary on South Archer Avenue in Chicago, and with the incredible success in the month of January with nearly $40 million of cannabis sold in Illinois, we've been talking about the issue here. And Neil, you mentioned that you yourself are a cancer patient, correct?
Correct.
And when did you decide that you were going to go the route of cannabis?
When I got diagnosed. It was about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been, you know, just working at the store. I was the day-to-day guy. I got the diagnosis, and I've been working with all these patients of mine who were using the medicine and saw the effect it had on them and the help it was giving them, and it was a no-brainer for me. All my patients that were using it were getting some benefit, whether it was getting the clearance for their treatments, chemo or radiation, or just feeling better after their treatments and helping. We have a number of patients that have given incredible testimonials about how the medicine has allowed them or their loved one to have higher functionality and better day-to-day living while they're treated with their disease. Mm-hmm. So I've experienced the same thing. In the beginning, I was a lawyer working at a cannabis dispensary, and now I'm an absolute true believer in the product and the medicine.
Wow, that's great. I know that you're 100% behind it, obviously, but is there still a stigma attached to marijuana, even if you're using it for medical reasons?
There is. The same stigmas that have always applied, the reefer madness, the hippies, it makes you stupid, the things like that, and they're just misinformed and outdated.
Yeah.
It's the smartest people I know, the most successful people I know, use cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak for the radio personalities, but the people I work with, the people I know, it enhances their lives.
Yeah. And I'm glad that it does. I'm glad that it's working for you. That's a really wonderful thing. It really is. And for all these other patients who have to deal with this illness, it's a really wonderful thing.
It's great to have. It's been too long in coming, but it's here now, and people are really taking advantage of it. And the medical professionals I talk to and I work with, they see it as well.
Yeah. It's Neil McQueenie is here, owner of Midway Dispensary on South Archer in Chicago. It's the Nick DeGilio Show, 312-981-7200. And, I always thought, before it, recreational marijuana became legal, I always thought that it was kind of unfair that people could go out and get loaded and buy liquor at a Walgreens and get smashed, but you couldn't get marijuana. And that was frowned upon, but drinking was, kind of glorified.
Right. You're 100% right. And it's the same thing with, the opioid prescriptions. It's, you can take as many as you want as long as you're not working, and then good luck on the next day.
Yeah.
There's a little hypocrisy in all that, and it's, he who wins or she who wins history gets to write it, things like that. So there's a lot of, political history, history about the product itself. And, we're getting out of those shadows, and we're all, it's a huge business. It's a huge industry. And people are seeing that now, and they're seeing the benefits of it. And it's, we're working together to make sure that we continue to progress towards it being treated better than the other products you talked about.
Yeah, yeah. There's a story here that's from CNN that scientists have discovered a weed compound that may be 30 times more powerful than THC, and they call it THCP. Any words on that?
That's the first I've heard of it.
Oh.
But I'm sure there's a ton of research being done on it.
Yeah. This story says that it may deliver 30 times the high of THC, or any high at all is unclear. Italian scientists also discovered a second previously unknown compound they named CBDP, and appears it to be a cousin of CBD. So there's still lots of scientific reports going on out there.
This is what we're dealing with politically. I mean, research can be done all over the world, but the United States, with the best research scientists in the world, are limited by the laws we have with the federal government and state government. So there's a ton of research that is ongoing, and we're going to learn a ton more about this plant and the cannabinoids that come with it, including more medical efficacies that the plant's going to give to patients around the world. Mm-hmm. It's happening. There is a lot more to learn about it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there's a lot more to learn about it. And I know that because of what's happening and not just in Illinois, but all over the place where it's legal, obviously more research is going to be put into it because they want to keep the product as safe and as possible.
Absolutely. And the research should be done because we do want to keep this the safest product we can.
So there are some people out there. We've been playing some PSAs here on the station about high driving, about driving when you're high. This is a concern, but people need to use, you talked about the restrictions on the use of the marijuana. People have to use their brains, again.
Right. Using your common sense and using your brains, always a good idea.
Yeah.
If you're talking about, you know, people using the product while they're about to go to work or use heavy machinery, I mean, it's common sense.
Yeah.
THC will alter your mind, and it's not safe to operate a vehicle. It's not safe to operate heavy machinery. There are certain things that you don't want to do if your mind is being altered with a chemical.
Right, and that's
you have to prepare for that. You have to plan for it. You know, that's why you have, you know, you can use Uber, you can all these other alternatives, so you don't have to put yourself or anybody else in jeopardy.
Yeah, and or you could just stay home.
Or stay home and get high.
Just stay home and get high. Right. Hey, does the airport like the fact that you're called Midway Dispensary?
I haven't heard. We're getting our new billboard up by the airport. It is it's Midway Dispensary, more red eyes than anybody else.
That is great.
We haven't heard anything negative yet. So
that is so great. That is great. Who came up with that, Neil?
I wish it was me.
Yeah.
So it was one of my partners at the store.
God, that's funny. That is so funny.
Yeah, Craig Custer.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Well, now that the business has slowed down, what are we looking at for the future here? Do you see the demand continue to be like huge?
Absolutely. Illinois is the fifth largest state. The demand's only going to get stronger. It's going to get bigger and better in Illinois. There's going to be 130 new dispensaries this year. There's going to be craft grows. There's going to be expansion of the current licensed cultivation centers. In Chicago, there's going to be consumption lounges when they get the ordinance all straightened out. So you can go to like a hookah bar, depending on, you know, what the ordinance says, but you can go to a place to consume your medicine because not all people can consume it in their private residence. So they want to create a safe place for them to use the medicine. And then there's going to be infusing licenses. So it's going to be more, better, and bigger, and great opportunities for the state of Illinois and its citizens.
It's astonishing how big this was. You know, when I saw the footage on television, when I read the numbers, just on January 1st alone, how it kept going throughout the entire month. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing, and bigger than I ever thought it would be.
Me too. I'll be honest. Me too.
Yeah. Well, hey, how many people are with you at Midway? You mentioned your brother and some other people. How big is the staff?
Oh, we got about staff-wise about 15 total with the owners on site.
Oh, that's great. Well, congratulations on all the success, Neil, and congratulations on using marijuana to help you get through a tough time.
Thank you very much, Nick. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
There you go. All right, Neil McQueeney is the owner of Midway Dispensary. They're at 5648 South Archer in Chicago. This has just been a phenomenon, and we wanted to get Neil's thoughts on it right here. All right, it's the Nick DeGilio Show continuing on 720 WGN.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, hey, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
WGN. It's the Nick DeGilio Show. Nick is out sick this morning. He is back home in bed, resting up. I'm his producer, Tom Hush, playing for you some of our favorite interviews of the last couple weeks. giving you a little bit of a catch-up so that when Nick returns, you'll be all caught up with the show, too, and everything will be brand new. Isn't that a nice thing? So we're reaching the final hour here, final half hour or so. We've got one more great interview to play. It's coming to us from our friend Herb Weisbaum, who is the consumer man. He writes for NBC and also KOMO Radio in Seattle. One of our absolute favorite guests joins us about once a month. He'll be coming back in just a couple of weeks, but we're going to give you a little extra dose of Herb since it is tax season. I know if you haven't filed already, you're going to be filing soon. So he's going to be talking about that and a bunch of other consumer stories here on this Best of Nick DiGilio show. Again, Nick is out sick. We wish him the best. If you want to send him an email, send an email to nickdshow@gmail.com with your well wishes and all that good stuff. But for right now, we'll cap everything off with a little visit from our friend Herb Weisbaum here on 720 WGN.
How you doing, Herb?
Very well, and 35 is not old. Take my word for it.
No, I know. But these things that turn 35 are going to make us feel like we're 105. So,
okay.
Yeah. All right. Herb, tell everybody about the Consumer Man, consumerman.com, and so on and so forth, and your background.
Sure. I'm the consumer reporter for NBCNews.com. Write stories that help you save time, save money, avoid the scams and ripoffs, that sort of thing. I keep all of them housed on my website, consumerman.com, so they're real easy to find. And if you go there, you can sign up for my newsletter, my weekly newsletter, where I'll send you out what I do and also the podcast of this hour from the Nick DiGilio Show.
There it is.
And I also reporter at KOMO Radio in Seattle. So my life is basically, for 40 years now, has been looking out for people and try to protect them and save them time and save them money.
And you certainly do that when you join us every month. It's always a great segment. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Herb, I've been getting some questions about something that we talk about frequently on the show, and it's robocalls. Have they decreased? And if some people might not know what a robocall is, can you explain what it is, and have they decreased at all, or are they still at an all-time high?
Sure. Basically, when we talk about robocalls, these are calls that are started by a computer, and then in most cases, they have an automated message on the that greets you. So it could be everything from, I got one today. Hi, this is your credit card company. We want to reduce your interest rate. Of course, it's not from my credit card company. Two, this is the Social Security office calling. Your benefits are going to be shut off because there's a problem. And unless you contact us right away, you're not going to get your benefits this month, which is probably the number one scam in America these days. Mm. Or the IRS one, which is you didn't pay your money, but it's a recording. This is the IRS. You didn't pay your taxes. We're going to send somebody over to arrest you if you don't call this number right away. So every robocall is not a scam, but most scams these days start with robocalls. Some robocalls we want, and people tend to forget that when they do robocall stories. I want to know when my prescription is ready at the pharmacy.
Right.
I get a robocall.
Right.
Oh, Mr. Weisbaum, your prescription is ready. You have 4 days to pick it up. I want a robocall from my airline. Your flight has been delayed 3 hours. Don't show up at the airport this morning. I want that robocall. I want the reminder from my vet, hey, your dog's due for his appointment next week. Those kind of things, but we asked for them. We opted in. We signed up for them.
Right.
It's the ones that come solicited that are the ones that drive us crazy. And there is some good news, actually, because all we keep hearing about robocalls is bad news, and it was a record year for robocalls last year. A report just came out a couple of days ago. So it's funny you should ask me about this, from a company called Nomo Robo. Now, a tiny little background about Nomo Robo. This was the company, I know the guy personally, Aaron Floss. He was the one who won the Federal Trade Commission's contest. It must have been 10 years now or something. I lose track of time. Where they said, we need this to help fight robocalls. Somebody come up with a solution. And he won the contest. It was a split prize between two people, $50,000 prize. And he came up with a computer program that could help screen the calls. If you have VoIP telephone service, that's like I'm talking to you now on a VoIP telephone line. Mm-hmm. That's cable company, or cell phone, you can get Nomo Robo is one of the services you can get to block the calls. I have it on my Comcast line, and what it does is it rings once to let you know it snagged the call, and then it disappears, and you never hear from it again. The service costs $1.99 if you have it on your cell phone. But they just, so that's who this group is. Good guys. They were one of the first to start working and successfully deal with robocalls. The report is as follows. 36% of all calls were bad robocalls. So that means some kind of scam call or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's pretty bad. But And that's, they analyze like billions of calls because everything comes through them. The good news is that was actually down 4.5-5%, let's say, from 2018. So because in 2018, 41% of all calls were bad robocalls. So that's actually moving in the right direction.
Mm.
And there's some indication that we may actually be throttling back in the number of robocalls we're getting these days. And there's several reasons why. Federal Trade Commission has been very, very active. They shut down four gigantic robocallers in March, and they took down about 100 more in June and another big one in December. So they're actually making some progress because some of these, you know, it's so cheap. You can be like some 400-pound guy sitting in your bedroom and literally run a robocall service because you just have computer technology that does this for all these other companies.
Yeah.
It's so cheap and so expensive. So they're trying to bust these people. Retailers are joining in the fight, making it a little bit harder for people to get gift cards to pay the robocallers, because that's often what they want. And these robocall blocking tools are starting to work. And with a new law that Congress passed that gives the feds more power to go after robocallers and gives them some more tools at their disposal, and these cell companies working on blocking technology, I think, hopefully, fingers and paws crossed, that we'll actually see the numbers go down in 2020 for the first time, and wouldn't that be lovely?
That would be great. By the way, it's Nick DiGilio Show here on 720 WGN. Herb Weisbaum is my guest. He's the Consumer Man. Check out consumerman.com. Yeah, and, you know, the robocalls are annoying on so many levels. I don't get that many, very infrequently, and I also, if I don't recognize the number, I don't answer. That's the first piece of advice that I give people who might be bothered by this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The problem we're having is because so many people are bothered by robocalls now that what they're doing is they're letting everything go to voicemail if they don't recognize the number, which is fine if you answer the call, because it could be something that's really important. You know, if your
right.
kid's in trouble and they're
right.
calling a cell phone that's their normal cell phone, your doctor could be calling you with test results and they could be in a different part of the clinic or whatever. So if you're going to do that, and I understand that, and I have no problem with hanging up the second I hear it's a robocall, but you know, then make sure you check your messages, or there's free technology available for all, both your phones, like I said, Nomo Robo and all your
right.
cell phones. Put it on there and block the calls and stop them from happening. Check with your cell phone carrier, because most of those are now starting to offer some kind of service as well. Say, hey, this is probably a scam call,
right.
and then you can decide how you want to handle them. So there are now tools at our disposal.
Okay. All right. Herb Weisbaum, we continue our conversation. He's the Consumer Man, consumerman.com, 312-981-7200. We got a lot of consumer news stories. And if you have issues or questions, please call us at 312-981-7200. The Nick DiGilio Show continues.
The best things in life are free, but you can keep them for the birds and bees. Now give me money.
All right. The Nick DiGilio Show continues. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. And we are live in the Skyline Studio. All right. Herb, you talk about stress. And the impact that it has on financial decisions. This is a piece that you wrote for NBCNews.com. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was fascinated by this study that was done by Capital One. It's called the Mind Over Money Study. And, you know, the economy is strong. The stock market is up. Unemployment is down. Inflation is under control. And yet millions of Americans are stressed about their finances. I'm sure you're aware of that. You talk to people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
In the story, I just the tone here, I looked at some at Reddit, and they have different posts from people who are struggling with debt. And I just want to read you a couple of these quotes to sort of set the tone for what we're going to talk about here. Here's one. Most messes in life are very hard, but a financial mess is absolutely devastating, stressful, beyond belief, and terrifying. Another one. I am 24, and I feel like my financial situation will suffocate me for the rest of my life. $35,000 in debt, another person writes. Don't know what to do. I make $62,000 a year, and I never have any money. It's embarrassing and exhausting. Mm. Just three that I quickly pulled at random. There's a lot of stress, a lot of depression out there. So Capital One, with this Mind Over Money study, wanted to sort of get some data, some numbers to go with it. And listen to these numbers. 77% of Americans said they feel anxious about their personal financial situation.
Mm.
77%. A couple other numbers. 58% said finances control their lives. 52% said they had difficulty controlling their money-related worries, and 68% said said they are worried about having enough money to retire. And the survey found, when they dug deeper, that all the stress, as you said, is really taking a toll in various ways. What they did is they surveyed 1,000 U.S. adults and found that these people reported feeling fatigued. They're having difficulty concentrating at work. It's causing sleep problems and a negative impact on relationships. So it's a really difficult situation. It's really something that people have to try to find a way to deal with, because the stress, as I write, leads to a lot of really bad decision making. You know, you can't make smart financial decisions when you're stressed.
Yeah, it's true. You know, and we've talked about this before, Herb. Personally, I went through a time when I was in an enormous amount of debt, and it is stressful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it does eat at you, and like mentally, and then ultimately physically, it has a toll.
Yeah, and again, the relationships, your life, and then the whole idea of making bad decisions. You know, the company called Decision Lab, they did all the research for this, and they deal with how people relate to things and make decisions. A behavioral scientist is what they are. And they said that when we are in stress, we feel less control. We tend to be worse at saving and budgeting and become much more impulsive with how we spend our money, because maybe that's the only thing we think we have control over or something. And they factored in, they ran the numbers again and factored in credit score and income, so to see if that had an impact. And they found that the mindset is what impacts everyone, regardless of your financial circumstances. So you could be very well off, you could have a very high credit score, but if you're still spending more than you're making or aren't making ends meet, it's not really based on money so much as based on money, income, outcome, your budgeting kind of thing. And it's, you know, it's really easy to tell people just don't be stressed, but that really doesn't work. And what I talked about at the end of the story was ways to get help. And I was actually thinking of you, because we've talked so much about it when I wrote this, about getting some help. And can I go through some of this?
Yeah, let me just reset here, Herb. As you know, sure. Herb Weisbaum is with us. It's the Nick DiGilio Show on 720 WGN, and that's what you're listening to. Herb Weisbaum is the consumer man. Yeah, please go ahead, Herb.
So here's what the one last point. These people at Decision Lab said, so normal people who are under stress, you go to a store and you try to decide which color of a certain product you should buy. They said the big picture view, which you should really be taking, is do I really need to buy that product in the first place? Do I want the product? Do I need the product? So the mindset, when it revolves around money, has to be the bigger picture thing, not what color, what flavor of ice cream do I buy when I'm at the supermarket today, but do I really need ice cream? Does it fit into my budget? So they'd like to see the bigger picture issue. But again, here's the help part. So obviously, as you know, if you need professional guidance, you can see a financial counselor, nonprofit credit counselor, and they can work on planning a budget and helping you get rid of credit card and student loan debt. A lot of them are now trained in student loan debts. A lot of people don't know that, so they can work with you on that. And you can see a financial planner to help you develop a financial game plan. But here's the new thing, and I really like this. A financial therapist. Have you ever heard of a financial therapist?
I have not.
It's a real new thing. They've only been offering courses in it for about 10 years, and they just started to certify them. So we're really at the cusp of a new kind of counselor here. A financial therapist is someone who has training in both financial and mental health issues. So it could be someone with a financial background who gets cross-training in mental health issues, or it could be someone who has mental health training and gets cross-trained in financial issues about money management. And what they're starting to understand is that this helps you connect better with your clients, it helps you make relationships with them, and help figure out the bigger problem, because it could be sometimes that it's not just financial, it could be that it's a emotional kind of thing. I'm spending money because I'm unhappy. I had a bad relationship with money when I was a kid. I'm doing this because my father never gave me money, or my parents got in debt. I don't want to do it. There could be a whole lot of emotional issues and mental issues are revolved around that, more than just the spreadsheet, which is not to say that's not important, but you have to do, they said, in many cases, more than just do that. You have to improve the mental outlook. So it's a very interesting thing. There are some of these starting to show up in different parts of the country. I saw some listed in the online ads here in the Seattle area. I'm sure they're in your area as well, but they're just starting to be certified through the Financial Therapy Association. So it will be a designation of a certified financial therapist. So it means there's some training and background behind it. And if you want to find out more, there's a link with my story about this on consumerman.com, some other helpful links as well. But that's just one other option. I think it's fascinating that they finally realized that money is related to self-esteem and worth and how we feel about things, and there'll be counselors and people who can work with both angles of the problem as opposed to just attacking one.
It also speaks to how widespread this is. I mean, the piece that you wrote, mm-hmm. these numbers that you said that are here are kind of astonishing. 77% of Americans feel anxious about the financial situation. So it's not surprising that they needed to create this financial therapist role. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I will also point out, and I think what you're basically saying is, you know, the numbers don't tell the full story. And a lot of times that's being used by politicians to paint an inaccurate or not complete picture. Yeah, the stock market's up, but if you're an American who doesn't have anything in the stock market and you're, you know, working part-time work to try to make ends meet and don't have a 401k, it really doesn't mean anything to you per se that the stock market's up. You didn't get any richer, any more wealth by that. If you're working two gigs and most of your money's going to daycare to make your bill payments, you're not feeling all these other things that we're seeing in the statistics. So the statistics are important. The economy, you want it to be strong, but you know, and it's been spoken about many, many times, we have an economy where a lot of people feel left out. A lot of people feel they're not being able to make ends meet, and that's what's creating all this stress, that it's as hard as they're working and as hard as they're struggling, they just can't keep up with the growing cost of living and how expensive everything is, and in some cases, how low the wages are or whatever, and that's what's creating this enormous frustration. A lot of these Reddit posts I look at, I work 40 hours a week, I work overtime, I do this, I have a good paying job, and I still can't make ends meet. I don't know what's going on. Some of it may be lack of self-control, but some of it may also be that it's dang expensive to live in this country these days.
Yeah, it is. It's the Nick DiGilio Show. We're talking with Herb Weisbaum, who visits with us every month. Check out consumerman.com. And if you have any consumer-related issues or concerns or questions, 312-981-7200. I find this interesting, Herb. I happen to have Capital One. I happen to be with Capital One, and I'm very satisfied with that credit card and how they, you know, they handle things with the alerts and everything. They're right on top of it all the time. I think they're a really great company. But how often do they do studies like this? Is this a normal thing? Because they're the ones responsible for this mind over money study that you're talking about in this piece. How often do credit card companies or Capital One in particular do these kind of things?
There are lots of studies done now by all kinds of financial entities, both credit card companies, banks, wealth management companies. They're always usually fascinating because they're trying to dig deep down into what's really making us tick. You know, there are quick studies that come out every week. I get dozens of them. You know, we surveyed 1,000 people and, you know, where do you owe most of your money to or whatever. But it's the ones where they really spend a lot of time and dig deeper into these things that are the ones I report on, because it really tells you and gives you a good picture of where the American public is. Some of them are focusing on millennials now. They want to find out what's really going on with them. We're finding out that despite the fact that a recent study, we always hear that millennials don't do credit cards. No, millennials do credit cards, and they're getting themselves deep into credit card debt. It's credit card debt and student loan debt. So it's not what we always thought about millennials. These studies really help put some data on the table so we really know what we're talking about. Others focus on seniors. Others sometimes focus on college kids. Some focus on what's happening in the credit card world. But there's a lot of research being done. In many cases, they're doing it to market to us, but also just a lot of solid information so we can get a better handle of our financial lives.
Yeah, I just think it's really kind of cool that the credit card companies and financial institutions are doing this. They don't really need to do this. I mean, you know, a lot of Capital One, I'm sure they're like, yeah, we love high balances. You know, we love that kind of stuff. But to go out and try to help people. Yeah,
and you said something that was really critical. I don't want that to pass. You talk about the alerts. You know, for everyone listening to this show, if you haven't set up alerts on your credit card, you are really passing up an opportunity to know about a fraudulent situation really, really quickly. I had a thing the other day when I bought some tickets online, non-credit card present transaction. I bought the tickets to James Taylor. He's coming to Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
And within 2 seconds, it was like, hi, this purchase was just made. Credit card not present. Did you really make this purchase, Capital One? And it was, if yes, thank you very much. And if no, contact us right away. We'll deal with it. I mean, dealing with fraud is like a real-time thing. The quicker you can deal with it, the better off you can be. And if you have these alerts set up on your bank account and your credit card account, you can set them up in about a minute. Just go to security alerts on your bank accounts or your credit card accounts. You can know if there's foreign transactions, a transaction over a certain amount, if anybody uses your credit card in any way, shape, or form, if anybody writes a check, all these kinds of things that will instantaneously let you know what's happening with your money. And it's really important in this day and age to have instantaneous feedback.
And you do. And I can vouch for Capital One. If I make a you know, an unusual purchase or something, I'm not kidding. It's a second after the purchase that I get an email. There's, it's like, it's that quick. And it's really important. It's easy to do, and it takes 2 seconds. Herb, we're going to come back and talk some more.
Okay, you got it.
All right. Herb Weisbaum is with us. He's the Consumer Man. Check out consumerman.com. If you have any consumer issues or problems or questions or concerns, 312-981-7200. More consumer news to talk about with Herb right here on 720 WGN as the Nick DiGilio Show continues. The Nick DiGilio Show continues here on 720 WGN, we're talking with Herb Weisbaum. And Herb, one of the stories that I wanted to get to is it's tax time, as you know. This is a busy time for it's a busy time for everybody in the world of finance. And you you put together a helpful article here that's available at consumerman.com or NBCNews.com about all the stuff that you need to know about filing your taxes, and sometimes possibly for free. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was the whole point of this story. The IRS has a program called Free File Program, and it's up and running right now. And if you qualify, and most low middle income Americans do, you can prepare your return now, and the preparation service will file it for you with the IRS for free. What basically happens is the IRS worked a deal out with a number of the big tax preparation services and says, you know, we won't do our own program, which has been some push, you know, that why doesn't the IRS just put out a program we can do our taxes? They're the experts. We'll let you do your thing, but you've got to help lower income Americans. So they agreed to do that. It's been going on now for a bunch of years, and it's called the Free File Alliance. So taking part this year are a group of companies. Some of them are familiar names, such as TurboTax, and H&R Block and TaxSlayer and TaxAct. And you won't necessarily qualify for everyone. There's certain restrictions based on your where you live and that sort of thing. But all you have to do is answer 6 questions, and you'll find the programs that are available to you. And basically, anyone with an adjusted gross income of $69,000 or less will qualify for at least one of these free file software packages. Adjusted gross income is where you get to the bottom line on your tax thing, and that's what, to the IRS, you made that year after you do everything. And some of the 10 companies will also prepare and file your state tax return for free as well for those listing in states where there's a state tax return. So the reason why I wanted to point this out was there was a big story done by ProPublica last year, and they pointed out that when their investigation, they found out that some of the big tax preparer companies, especially Intuit, which is the maker of TurboTax, and H&R Block, took steps to keep the free file versions of their products from showing up when people did a Google search. And so as part of the deal, everyone has agreed to make this more knowledgeable to people, make it more obvious to people that you can do these programs. And so it's really important. All you have to do is go to IRS.gov and then look for Free File Program, and you can see in about 60 seconds whether you qualify to have your returns done. And these are the people that are making the really good, big, expensive software that people are buying to do their taxes with, that if you qualify, you can have it done for free. I mean, why not? As you said, free is a very good price.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. I also looking at the piece here, and why are so many few people taking advantage of this? You said that fewer than 1.6% took advantage of the program in 2018. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah. It's probably because the program isn't that well publicized. Some of the criticism was, as I said before, the companies weren't making it easy for people to know about it.
Yeah.
So those of us in the consumer world are doing everything we can to make people know that this is the first place to go. Also want to point out that some major tax preparation services, such as TurboTax, have what they call free versions on their websites. And there's a real important difference everybody needs to know here. If you get the, if you start the free version on their website, and for some reason you need forms that are not part of that free version, the website is going to ask you to pay money. You will never have that happen when you do the free file through the IRS free file program. So my advice is, if you're going to try to do it for free, why monkey around on a company's website that we know they're trying to make money? Start at the IRS website where you know it's free. IRS.gov, and then just look for Free File. It's right there on the homepage, and it's really, really easy to do.
Okay. We got a text that just came in. Herb, and it says, why for people who make $69,000 a year or less, what's the difference?
That was just the deal that the IRS negotiated with the tax preparation companies. They had to put a number on it somewhere, so they put that number on it, and that's what they all agreed to.
Okay. All right. And
it does mean a lot qualify. You know, a lot of Americans qualify for that.
Yeah. Okay. Also, you know, there is the option to talk in person, correct?
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, taxes are intimidating to a whole lot of people. I pay somebody to do my taxes because I can't count to 12 on two fingers.
Yeah, I do the same. I do the same thing, Herb, and I have the same problem. So
you do numbers, and I'll do talking. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
So, but a lot of people want to do it themselves, but they want just a little bit of help or some guidance. So there are a number of programs where people can do that. The IRS has the VITA program, that's Volunteer Income Tax Program, and this is for people with an annual income of $56,000 or less, folks with disabilities and taxpayers with limited English, and you will be working with IRS-certified volunteers that will give you free basic income tax preparation. They'll help you do the return and file it for free. And then there's also the IRS has the Tax Counseling for the Elderly program, the TCE program, and that will help free tax help for all taxpayers. But they really specialize in those of us who are 60 and older, because a lot of the questions that we have are relating to pensions and retirement-related issues and that kind of thing, and they're really highly trained in that area. And then finally, the ARP Foundation has its Tax Aid program, which will give free tax preparation for low to moderate income taxpayers, especially 50 and older, but you don't really have to make an age qualification. There are 5,000 locations nationwide. You don't even have to be an AARP member, and they will work with you to try to get this done. A lot of names, a lot of places. All you have to do is go to my website, consumerman.com, look for File Your Taxes for Free, and I have links to every one of these programs where it gives you the locator page, and it tells you how you can find the service in your area. So that's real, real easy to do.
Okay. It's Nick DiGilio here on the Nick DiGilio Show, and we're talking with Herb Weisbaum. He is the Consumer Man, consumerman.com. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. There is still time to lower your tax bill. There are a couple of things that you can do to lower it.
There are only two things you can do, because basically everything was locked in as of December 31st at midnight. What you can do is, if you have a traditional IRA and you have not made your full IRA contribution or made an IRA contribution, the clock on that ends on tax day, April 15th. So if you want to make a 2019 contribution, and you have to make it really clear on all the paperwork you do that this is your 2019 contribution, you can do $6,000 and put it away, or $7,000 if you're age 50 or older. You have up to April 15th, and that deduction comes off this year's taxes. So to the IRS, it's like you didn't make that money, and you're putting it away in something that's going to earn interest for you and be around for when you want to retire. As we spoke earlier, one of the biggest stresses of people these days is they won't have enough money to retire. So that's right. One thing you can do. If you have a high deductible health plan and you have a health savings account, this is something you've set up to help pay for your medical expenses, you can again make contributions to that health savings account through April 15th, and it will count as a deduction on your 2019 taxes. So those are the two things you can do to possibly lower your tax return, liability for this year.
Okay. And again, what you need to know about filing for free, this whole article is available at the website that we're talking about, consumerman.com, with links to all these places that can help you. And the full article is definitely worth a read, as almost everything that Herb writes is. Check out consumerman.com.
Two other tax-related things that I just happened to find out about in the last couple of days, because I work on all things all the time. There's going to be a brand new question on the tax form this year that the IRS put on there, and it's going to ask you, did you have any dealings with cryptocurrency? The first time they're going to ask that question.
Mm.
And if you say yes, then you're going to have to – that's a reportable situation to them. And this is going to be, Nick, very complicated for everybody who uses Bitcoin and all these other things, because the IRS has decided, at least for now, that these digital currencies are being treated as property and not currency.
Oh, I see.
If it were treated as currency, that's not a tax reportable consequence. I mean, when you buy something with currency, that's not tax reportable. Property things are reportable. That's how you do capital gains and do things. So as the the guy from the H&R Block, one of the experts at the H&R Block Tax Institute, told me today, if you bought a newspaper, which you can do with Bitcoin, and if you bought a travel package or airfare with Bitcoin, as you can do, and if you bought, you know, a pizza with Bitcoin, as in some places you can do, every one of those things to the IRS is considered a transaction, and you've got to deal with that. And unlike your traditional investments, you know, we get the statements from our mutual funds or our stock funds or whatever every year. Just you give it to your accountant or you copy the numbers down, right? You don't get that with digital currencies. You've got to do all that math on your own.
Oh, man.
This is going to be a nightmare for people, an absolute nightmare. So that starts this year. So I want to point. The other thing is the IRS is now requiring a brand new W-4 form for everybody who gets employment starting the beginning of 2020. And you're only required to do that if you are in a brand new hire for this year. And what it does is it takes away the traditional allowances that you have. And it's a much more fine-tuned product. So it lets you do math, and it actually lets you figure in that you have a side gig, but it's in a way that you don't have to tell your employer you're working somewhere else. It's just the number you put in and all that kind of stuff. So if you're hired this year, you're going to have to do that. But the reason I'm bringing this up is if you find out when you get your tax return that either you owe a heck of a lot of money or you are getting a huge refund, which is not the smart way to do your taxes. You gave Uncle Sam a free loan for a year. You're supposed to come out like just a little bit one way or the other, or dead even is the smart way to do it. Go to your employer and say, can I fill out a brand new W-4 form and set your numbers right so you're on the right path for 2020 so you don't get hit with a huge tax bill or you have a whole lot of money that you could have been making interest on or spending or paying bills with that you let Uncle Sam keep till the end of the year. So that's why I wanted to point that out to everybody. Okay.
And Herb, it is always a pleasure to have you on. I learned something, and it's always insightful when you're here.
Thank you, Nick. I say this every time, but it's the truth. It's the highlight of my month, and I look forward to seeing you in March.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you, Herb. Herb Weisbaum, everybody, he joins us once a month. He's an incredibly helpful guy, and you learn something every time. Every time he's on, I learn something, and I hope you do too. And I hope you take advantage of his free newsletter, and you check out the website at consumerman.com. We all have to be safe. We all have to be vigilant, and Herb's one of the good guys. He wants to help us all out. All right, the Nick DiGilio Show continues after the news.
720 WGN, this is the Nick DiGilio Show. Nick has been out this morning because he's not feeling too well, been a little under the weather, so he's at home getting some well-deserved rest and relaxation. We'll have him back as soon as possible. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the best of the last couple of weeks. It's been a lot of fun looking back on some of these interviews. They're always a privilege to have so many interesting people join us on the Nick DiGilio Show. But the show will be back tonight at 11 p.m. and we'll go until 4 as always.